Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
And joining us today from San Francisco is Geronimo Gijaga's friend and former attorney, Stuart Hanlon. Hanlon's a criminal lawyer who began working on Pratt's case when he was a law student and stayed for 23 years until Pratt won his freedom in 97. And we're joined on the phone from Los Angeles by Ed Boyer, who began writing about Pratt's case in the early 90s for the Los Angeles Times, where he was a reporter for 20 years, now retired. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Stuart Hanlon, let's go to you first. In a nutshell, describe this case, and especially for young people, describe what COINTELPRO is, the counterintelligence program, and how a Reagan-appointed attorney, a Reagan-appointed judge, ultimately overturned the conviction of Geronimo Gijaga, the jury never having known that the person who pointed the finger at Geronimo Gijaga falsely was a police and FBI informant.
I think the place to start is the question that you guys asked Geronimo years ago. Do you think it proves the system works because you won? And Johnny, at one point, it's one of the few differences he and I had, and he said the same system that locked up Geronimo let him free. Well, the system doesn't work. And if it took, as Geronimo pointed out, it took 27 years of his life to free an innocent man. And what people should understand, and which I think we kind of understood back then, but not to the extent it was proven, is that our government, and you say government because it is the FBI with the president, local law enforcement in Los Angeles, district attorneys, conspire to convict somebody and lock them up and have them face the death penalty because of their political beliefs and affiliations. Is that back in the 60s and early 70s, the Panthers were considered by J. Edgar Hoover and many others, especially in the white community, as the number one threat to the safety of America. And imagine that we felt that a group of young African Americans, probably less than 1,000 throughout the country, were the number one threat to our internal safety. And because of that, these law enforcement people and judges and district attorneys felt that the ends justified the means to get rid of them by any means necessary. And we've learned that Fred Hampton was murdered, another Panther, in Chicago, and Geronimo was framed. And people say, how do you know it was framed? It was just some technicality. And I think the best image is that Julio Butler was asked by Johnny on a number of occasions, were you an informant for any agency? And he said over and over, no. And as it turned out, and I think what got Judge Dickey, is that he was an informant not just for the FBI, but for the L.A. Police Department, and finally for the L.A. District Attorney's Office. And these three agencies sat in court, because the FBI was there, and let this man lie and commit perjury to convict somebody. That's not a technicality. That's the breakdown of our criminal justice system. That's the highest level of people involved letting someone commit perjury, because they don't like him and like his beliefs. And I think the last question you asked, Amy, what does it say to people today, young people, like Geronimo and I were 40-some years ago, and even Johnny was pretty young back then, that paranoia is healthy, that now our new enemy may not be the Black Panther Party or African-American groups, but the new enemy could be Mid-Eastern people or Muslims. And we demonize them as the Panthers were demonized, and then we justify trials without juries, trial without, in military courts. We justify, setting up military courts in Cuba, in Guantanamo. We justify all these things in the name of protecting our country. And what we don't understand is our country falls apart when we do these things, and the legal system falls apart when we let these things happen. And that's the ultimate, not personal story of Geronimo, but the political story, I think.
Stuart Hanlon, can you talk about the judge who ultimately overturned the conviction?
Judge Dickey, we were in Los Angeles, a bunch of lawyers. It was Johnny and me and a bunch of other people, Mark Rosenbaum of the ACLU, Julie Drouse in San Francisco, Robert Garcia. It was a lot, and we thought we'd get a liberal judge in L.A. And the whole bench recused themselves because they said we can't hear the case because the XDA who we were attacking was now a judge. So we got sent to Orange County and everybody said, oh, you're behind the orange curtain. You're finished. We're going to get, and then we get this Republican judge appointed by Reagan, and we thought we were over. And what we didn't understand is we found a true conservative who believed in the Constitution. And every time we walked into court, we had a Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, which was unusual in courthouses at that point. But it set a tone of we were going to follow the rules. And I think he was really moved by the evidence. I think Johnny Cochran had an incredible presence in that courtroom. And Judge Dickey was offended at the deepest place that a good judge can be at how justice was turned on his head. The things Ed was talking about, that these cops came in and this young investigator came in for the DA, and they proved Butler was an informant. I mean, the DA said, the judge said, I didn't know this judge, Richard Kalustian, who was the DA. And then this young investigator came in and said, here's our informant file from 1970. And Julio's Butler, I found it by looking under B. And you could see in the courtroom how it just fell apart. And it wasn't just Butler. There were so many other things that showed Pratt was innocent. But by the end, I was watching last night a video of Geronimo getting bail. And Johnny said, how about $1,000 for each year? Let's set it at $25,000. And Judge Dickey literally had tears in his eyes when he granted it. He was moved by Geronimo, this ex-Vietnam vet, and the proof that he was framed by the country. Dickey believed it. I think it shook the judge to his core to see what had occurred. I just want to say one thing, Amy, in terms of what Ed did. It was amazing. The media, Ed and another reporter for the Times before Ed, Austin Scott, they made this a national story. You know, they made this something that couldn't go away. And you know, the power of the press and what Ed Boyer did and Austin Scott was truly amazing in moving Geronimo's case forward.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, May 20, 2021. So I have been told. This is our 12th study session on Jack Olson's Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. The audio segment that we heard at the beginning, that is Gus T's BFF, Amy Goodman. So she interviewed Geronimo Pratt's attorney, suspected racist Stuart Hanlon. She interviewed him shortly after Geronimo Pratt passed away. So Johnny Cochran had already passed away, so she's gone over the case with Mr. Hanlon. A lot of what he talks about in that interview, or at least the portions that we heard, that is where we will be at in this portion of the text for this week, particularly when they go back in Orange County. We talked quite a bit about Orange County. That's supposed to be considered, I guess, conservative area, whatever that means. Reagan country, whatever that means. Nixon country, whatever that means. In fact, there's a documentary, Black Behind the Orange Curtain. We had the filmmakers on the cows. Whew, what have we been doing for a decade plus? Anywho, but that what you just heard from Mr. Hanlon, that will be discussed in detail in the portion that we read for this week. Also, make sure that I get in quickly. Last week, they talked about the McMartin School case with alleged Satanism and child sexual abuse and all of this. I said I'd never heard of that case before. They brought that up with this in the string of, I guess, infamous scandalous cases involving the L.A. prosecuting attorney's office and how they lost all these cases in an embarrassing fashion in some ways. Again, the crown jewel of all this being O.J. Simpson. But we just discussed that on this past Thursday. At the beginning of this week, NPR had this massive segment talking about QAnon, and I guess a lot of the followers have some sort of belief that there are rife satanic and child rape cults run amok in the U.S., and they said that there's a long history of this in the U.S., that this was a big thing back in the 80s, lots of people having paranoia about satanic cults and child sex abuse, and they devoted a healthy chunk of the segment to the McMartin School in California. I was absolutely stunned. Like, I had never heard of that incident, that case at all, and then within a matter of days of us talking about it in the book club, whammo. Anywho, our timing continues to be pretty good. We will go ahead and get started. Context of white supremacy. Last man standing. Getting close to the end. Audio segment one.
Chapter 55, Media Blitz. So we were stuck in the mud, Jim McCloskey said later. Johnny was busy with OJ, and Stuart and I were spinning our wheels. We decided to try another media blitz for two reasons. First, there was a slim chance that Garcetti had a sense of shame, and second, we needed public support. Before the PR campaign even began, the Los Angeles Times produced a major article. On Tuesday, May 24, 1994, the newspaper's 1,104,651 readers awoke to a page one story about an honored institution, the First African Methodist Episcopal Church, the city's oldest and biggest black congregation with 9,000 members. The chairman of its board of trustees, Julius Carl Julio Butler, now 61, was described as a native Angeleno, a wounded Marine sergeant from the Korean War, a former sheriff's deputy, a campaign volunteer for former Mayor Tom Bradley, a criminology alumnus of Los Angeles City College, and a staff worker for Los Angeles Legal Aid. But the news hook for the long article was the picketing of the church by protesters carrying signs saying, "The snitch got to go. Free Geronimo." The Times headline read, "A pillar of First AME under fire." The former beautician and mayor of Adams Boulevard was now an attorney, his image sanitized and his rap sheet laundered. The rehab project had begun 3 days after the Pratt conviction in 1972, when Richard Kalustian asked the Superior Court to reduce Butler's fine in the Ollie Taylor beating case from $200 to the $80 already paid. The prosecutor also arranged to have Butler's felony convictions reduced to misdemeanors. A few stigmatizing words about Butler's use of violence, menace, fraud, and deceit were expunged from the record on another motion by Kalustian, clearing the way for the ex-Panther's admission to law school and subsequently to the California bar. The same newspaper that had referred to Pratt 24 years earlier as a disastrous byproduct of the Vietnam War, a black man trained as a soldier who returned home to turn his skills against the establishment, now portrayed him as a sympathetic figure, a decorated Vietnam veteran from Louisiana, whose supporters said that his case symbolizes a legal system that was twisted to prosecute a political enemy. Times staff writer Edward J. Boyer described Butler as the linchpin in Pratt's controversial conviction and quoted the church leader as saying, "I still say I stand by the testimony." Johnny L. Cochran Jr. was also quoted, "Now he's passing himself off as this pillar of the community. An innocent man is in jail. If you're a real Christian, I don't know how you can live with that. And I don't think you can just stonewall it forever. First AME's pastor, the Reverend Cecil L. Chip Murray, found himself squeezed. Years earlier, he'd affixed his signature to an amicus curiae brief supporting a new trial for Pratt. Now, the leaders of his 3,500-member men's group backed Butler with a strong vote of confidence. Murray chose not to comment. The Times article set the tone for media coverage that soon turned global. The London Times ran a commentary favorable to Pratt. Articles in magazines and law journals sniped at the FBI, LAPD, and the district attorney. Kathleen Cleaver was widely quoted. Pratt is a political prisoner. If he were a murderer, he would have been freed years ago. Fox TV aired a four-part series plus follow-ups, and the CBS Evening News featured Eye on America told the Pratt story twice. Internet websites recapitulated the history of COINTELPRO and the Black Panthers and referred to the FBI fix. Cochran discarded his lawyerly collegiality and publicly criticized his old classmate Richard Kaloustian in a Gentleman's Quarterly article entitled "The Other Case That Obsesses Johnny Cochran." He was quoted as saying, "He shouldn't even be on the bench. He clearly knew about Julius Butler. He had to have known that. He knew the man was an informant, and he let him sit there and lie to a jury. And now there's this innocent man still sitting in prison, and Kaloustian has never spoken out. I don't know if he's morally capable of being on the bench." Pratt's supporters picketed the courthouse where Cochran and the DA's office were trying the O.J. Simpson case. Placards said, "Uncage the Panther, free Geronimo. No justice, no peace, till Geronimo's release." Accredited Simpson case correspondents became interested in Pratt and filed stories of their own. John Mack, head of the Los Angeles Urban League, publicly urged the DA's office to move the case along. Jewish leader Stanley Sheinbaum, a longtime Garcetti supporter, urged him to do the right thing. Pasadena Mayor William Paparian charged that your office secured a conviction, but justice has not yet been done for the accused. Patrick Leahy of Vermont and other U.S. senators made personal appeals. Marlon Brando, Sean Penn, and other Hollywood celebrities issued statements. Complaints reached the desk of U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. A reporter asked Hanlon how he and Cochran managed to keep climbing the same hill. "You know," said Rumpold of the Bailey, "Nelson Mandela's attorneys had no expectations for 20 years, but they kept going because that is what life is about. They refused to give in, and so we will. We will not let these people break us down." In mid-1995, with Cochran and the DA's office still squared off in the Simpson murder trial, the Pratt forces decided to give up on Garcetti and make a final desperation move in the courts. "We had to do something," Hanlon explained later. "Geronimo was at a low ebb. After all these years, he was losing it. He'd had his hopes dashed so many times. He'd fathered two kids in the certainty that he'd be getting out. Now, Shona was 16 and Hiroji was 12, and he couldn't even get back to San Quentin to see them. One afternoon, McCloskey and Hanlon drove to Mule Creek for another strategy session. Pratt looked wan and downcast. Hanlon started to discuss another writ of habeas corpus, and Geronimo dismissed the idea with a wave. "What's the use, man?" he said. "We'll just lose again." McCloskey said, "You're probably right, G, but we'll generate some heat. We have plenty of legitimate issues." "Legitimate? Yeah," Pratt reminded him. "And old." "They may seem old to you and me," McCloskey insisted, "but they've never been addressed by the courts. Garcetti can push us around, but in court, we're all equal." Half jokingly, Geronimo said, "Reverend, the only reason you're optimistic is because you don't have a firm grasp of the situation. Now, Stu and me, we've been kicked in the nuts so many times, we stopped believing in Santa Claus." "Maybe so," Hanlon said, "but we've still got options. The only one we don't have is..." "Yeah, I know," Geronimo said. "Quitting." They'd always completed each other's sentences. At the end of the long visit, Hanlon summed up their unanimous decision. "Our chances in court are between zero and none. So, we've got to file." The thankless job of drafting the brief for another habeas corpus petition fell to Juliana Drouse, the star writer on the Pratt team. Her husband, civil rights attorney Joel Kirschenbaum, had once filed an amicus curiae brief on Geronimo's behalf and visited him at Christmas time at Folsom. Twice, Julie Drouse had argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, where the justices succeeded in irking her German-born mother. "There you were in that beautiful new suit," Haiti Drouse complained in her thick accent. "You were gorgeous. Do you think one of those judges could have said how nice you looked?" By October 1995, Drouse was halfway through a first draft and doggedly following Hanlon's instruction. "This one has to be perfect, Julie. We can't give them the slightest excuse to throw us out, because they will." He kept reminding her that Pratt's last petition, filed 3 years earlier by Robert Bloom, had had a shelf life of 24 hours. At Thanksgiving time, a month after Drouse started work on the brief, her mother suffered a severe heart attack. Drouse flew to Philadelphia to be at her bedside and worked on the petition at night. Sometimes she slept as long as 2 or 3 hours. In early December, Hanlon's phone rang with a collect call from Mule Creek State Prison. His client was irate. "I thought you told me our petition would be filed this year," Pratt said. "I did," Hanlon replied. "But Julie's mother is dying. It doesn't matter whether we file it this year or early next year." "I'll be up front with you, Stu," Geronimo said. "It matters. I've got commitments. You guys are making me look bad." "Commitments? Who with?" My contacts. People in Asia. Africa. Man, you got to file that petition before the first of the year." "Julie can't possibly get it done by then. We've gone too far to screw up now. She needs another 6 weeks. Why? Didn't you hear what I just said about Julie? Juliana Drouse, attorney at law? This woman who's been working for you for 20 years, for free? Her mother's dying, for Christ's sake. Yeah, but Hanlon lost his temper and hung up, then spent the rest of the day fighting guilt feelings. Geronimo might have waited hours for the privilege of making the call. He might not get another chance for days. Now he was back in his cell with nothing settled and another sleepless night ahead. G was serving the time, not Hanlon, not Drouse, or Cochran, or anyone else. His lead attorney could never allow himself to forget that fact. But he had. A few days later, Hanlon was hit by the full force of Geronimo. He was crazed. He tried to fire me. He phoned everybody. He sent letters, demanded meetings. He called me collect and said, "You're off the case, asshole." He told Jim McCloskey that I was out. He said, "He can't fire me, Jim. I'm not leaving." I told my wife, "This is terrible. Kathy, how can he do this to me?" She just said, "You're hearing 24 years of frustration and misery. If you don't understand that, you're not much of a friend." She said, "If my oldest client wanted to fire me, I certainly wouldn't be discussing it with him on the phone." Hanlon arrived at the prison during non-visiting hours. He was ushered into an empty visiting room with its steel gray tables and coin machines. A sullen Geronimo arrived behind the sound of his own grumbling. "You and those other assholes really fucked me up with my people. I lost a lot of support. Why can't you dipshits do anything on time?" "I'm sorry, G," Hanlon responded. "Don't you understand, man? I'm dealing with issues. People. Timing. I'm dealing with Mandela, Mobutu, Tutu." Mandela, Mobutu, Tutu. Hanlon repeated to himself in wonderment. How come he left off King Hussein? This must be some kind of synaptic misfire. G had been having more of them lately. "If you say you're going to file something in 1995, Pratt went on, "then goddammit, file it in fucking 1995. Hanlon's patience was waning. "That's not the real problem, G," he said. "The real problem is you've been reading your own press." "Fuck you, man." Hanlon said, "Why don't you cut out the bullshit and tell me what's the real issue here?" "The real issue is you're fired. I already told you 20 times you can't keep firing your lawyers." "I want Cochran to take over the case," Geronimo said. "He'll put up a fight." "Johnny's a little busy." "The OJ case is over." Footnote 67. A not guilty verdict had been returned on October 3, 1995. End of footnote. Now he can get back to the GP case. Hanlon said, "Johnny can't help you without me and Julie and Jim McCloskey and all the rest of us poor slobs that have been working for you for free. Johnny can do anything, and he's never charged me a dime. Neither has anybody else. Johnny's up to his ass. He hasn't kept track of the nuts and bolts of this case, and he'd be the first to admit it. He'd never hang up the phone on me. Neither would I if you didn't act like a jerk." Hanlon disengaged long enough to drop 8 quarters into the cigarette machine. After he lit up, Geronimo said, "I thought you quit." "I did." "Give me one." "I thought you quit." "Give me a fucking cigarette, man." The two old friends smoked furiously against each other. After a long silence, Hanlon said, "I'll talk to Johnny for you, but I know what he'll say." He was halfway out the door when he heard Geronimo's parting shot. "Send your wife the next time. I need a good lawyer." The last word he heard was, "Dickhead." Cochran emitted one of his patented hoarse laughs when Hanlon recounted the conversation. "Is this the first time a client called you a body part?" Cochran asked. "I guess you haven't been doing your job." On a break from the post-Simpson hubbub, Cochran flew to Sacramento and called on Pratt at Mule Creek. "Stewart's the focal point of your case, Geronimo," he said. "He's been with you for how long?" 21 years? Too fucking long." "And you want to fire him now?" "Geronimo, get a grip. You can't fire your lead attorney, and you can't fire all those other folks who helped. Man, if you keep coming up with ideas like that, I'm going to be representing you in a sanity hearing." Pratt asked, "Will you help out?" "Of course I'll help out. When did I stop? I've just been a little sidetracked. That's all." Chapter 56. Substantial issues. The first weeks of 1996 passed with no word from the DA's office. After conferring with Hanlon, the Reverend Jim McCloskey fired a final warning shot in a 1,300-word press release that was printed in the Los Angeles Times and other newspapers. He affirmed Centurion Ministries' belief in Pratt's innocence, took Gil Garcetti to task for 2.5 years of inaction, lambasted the FBI, LAPD, Richard Calustian, and Julius Butler, threatened a new writ of habeas corpus, and charged that Pratt's conviction was based on false testimony knowingly presented by the prosecution. 3 days later, Juliana Drouse delivered her brief to Hanlon's office in the Haight, then flew back to Philadelphia to be with her mother during Haiti Drouse's last days. The draft contained 78 pages of argument, 80 legal citations, and 3 volumes of evidence logs. This case, the briefing specialist had written, represents a complete breakdown of the adversarial process, a travesty unworthy of our judicial system. With telephone input from the client, the team of Hanlon and Cochran spent a week weaving their own ideas into the document. This, Hanlon predicted, will be the finest petition the courts have ever turned down. Under California statutes, the petition could be filed anywhere in the state. Let's not waste time, Cochran advised. Wherever we go, we're gonna get kicked back to L.A. Let's file it there. It proved to be a brilliant decision, but for unexpected reasons. Elmer Gerard Pratt's fifth petition for a writ of habeas corpus was hand-delivered to the Los Angeles Superior Court clerk on Monday, February 26, 1996. It charged that the prisoner had been convicted on false evidence, had been denied material exculpatory evidence, and that newly discovered evidence proves petitioner is innocent. In a press conference, Hanlon told a dozen reporters, "Since Mr. Pratt was imprisoned, wars have started and ended. O.J. Simpson was arrested, tried, and acquitted. But Gil Garcetti has refused to act in the case." Hanlon said the defense team has grown tired of waiting on Mr. Garcetti to make an honest decision based on evidence and justice. His decision has been to avoid this case altogether. He accused Garcetti of treating the McCloskey report as a political thing he could play with. He said that Pratt could never be paroled because he won't show remorse for a crime he did not commit. All he ever had to say was, "I did it. I'm sorry." Geronimo has never said what the parole board wanted. A spokesman for Garcetti said he stood by his actions. Once again, the LA courts moved swiftly, but this time in Pratt's favor. Less than 72 hours after the petition was filed, Supervising Judge James A. Baskew announced that he found merit in the petition and issued an order to show cause, forcing the DA's office to respond. McCloskey attributed the order to media pressure and a little divine intervention. When the case was assigned to Superior Court Judge Michael Cowell, Cochran advised Hanlon, "Mike was a public defender. He's a good judge, a fair guy." "He may be a good judge and a fair guy," Hanlon reminded his colleague, "but he's an L.A. judge." In a light rain, 50 demonstrators assembled outside the criminal court's building to chant slogans, wave placards, and catch a glimpse of the former Black Panther Deputy Minister of Defense, now 48, but as light-footed as ever. He'd been brought in from Mule Creek for the first formal hearing on the order to show cause. It was Thursday, March 28, 1996, and spectators overflowed into the hall. Former juror Jeannie Hamilton confessed to a journalist, "I'm scared to death, and I want to look at him and tell him I'm sorry." Another reporter asked Cochran what had gone wrong in the first Pratt trial. Cochran replied, "I didn't know I was up against the entire government." Three Pratt siblings, Virginia, Jack, and Charles, squeezed into the front row and returned their brother's smile. With the ponderous case slowly gathering momentum, the Pratt team had been reinforced by Mark Rosenbaum of the American Civil Liberties Union, Robert Garcia of the NAA's Legal Defense Fund, and private investigator David Lynn. The usual Pratt runners, some of them now attorneys at law, stood by as they'd been standing by since 1972. When court convened, Judge Cowell acknowledged that the petitioner had raised some very substantial issues. But so had the DA's office, he continued. Gil Garcetti asked Cowell to send the habeas corpus petition directly to the California Supreme Court. During a recess, Hanlon analyzed the situation for reporters. We put Garcetti in a tight spot with our publicity campaign. Everybody knows about the case now. If he tries to get our petition thrown out, he loses black voters. But if he doesn't take a strong position, he loses the law and order white voters. So he's trying to lay it off on the state Supreme Court. Then, whatever happens, it's not his fault. In the afternoon session, Judge Cowell chided the DA's office for the reptilian pace of its review. Harry Sondenheim explained that the delay had been necessary in the interests of truth and justice, concepts the district attorney's office continues to pursue in this case. Hanlon shot back, "We are not going to sit here and listen to people who have had this case for 3 years talk about truth and justice." He ridiculed the attempt to transfer the case to the state Supreme Court. "This is a no-brainer," he told the judge. "The district attorney is engaged in a blatant attempt to shop around for the right forum. This is pure desperation." He took his seat and whispered to Cochran, "Did you see Cowell's face? He never looked at me. He's gonna grant this bullshit motion." "He can't," Cochran said. "He's got to go by the law." Just watch. For one of the few times in their relationship, Cochran was wrong. Hanlon sat next to Julie Drouse on the return trip from Los Angeles to San Francisco. "Stu felt so bad he forgot to help the pilot fly the plane," Drouse said of the white knuckle flyer later. "We were sick, miserable," he said. "What the hell is gonna happen next?" I said, "Stu, it's something about this case. It's snake bit. Think of all the other crazy rulings." Hanlon told her, "Whenever we go into court, we know we're gonna lose. But why can't we lose according to law? Why is it always something out of left field? So unfair." By a vote of 7-0, the California Supreme Court seemed to agree with Hanlon. Less than a month after Judge Cowell had kicked the case upstairs, the High Court kicked it back. Cowell was ordered to proceed to disposition. A jubilant Hanlon told a reporter, "This is the first time since the Republicans took over the governorship. This is the first time since the Republicans took over the governorship 16 years ago that a California Supreme Court has voted 7-0 in favor of a criminal defendant." Jim McCloskey said, "We are all absolutely thrilled. We're delighted, and we think that what this means is that finally, after 24 years of unjust imprisonment, Geronimo Pratt is going to get his day in court." Cochran was coldly realistic. "I once won a murder case in Cowell's court, but he still makes me nervous." Chapter 57, Confidential Informant. in mid-June, Harry Sondheim filed a 113-page brief arguing that Pratt's request for a new trial was speculative, groundless, and unwarranted. Public pressure brought by uninformed citizens, celebrities, politicians, and journalists, the veteran prosecutor wrote, cannot be the basis for an evidentiary hearing when there is no credible or new evidence to support such a hearing. He accused the Pratt attorneys of offering the court a rehash. While Hanlon and Drouse were drafting a reply in their San Francisco office, Hanlon took a phone call from Sondheim's co-counsel, Brentford J. Ferreria. Although they were on opposite sides, the two lawyers enjoyed a casual, bantering relationship. As Hanlon recalled the conversation later, Ferreria said, "We've come up with some new information, Stu. You and Cochran will try to make a big thing out of it, but in the end, we'll show that it's meaningless." Hanlon responded, "You found Dr. Mingle?" Ferreria ignored the crack and said, "We're going to Judge Cowell to get an order to keep it in camera till we do a little more investigation." To keep what in camera? "The new stuff that I can't tell you about." Hanlon was irritated. "Fuck that shit, Brent," he said. "Either you got something important or you don't. And if you got something important, we want it now." Ferreria replied that for once in his life, Rumpled of the Bailey would have to be patient. Hanlon called Los Angeles and asked Cochran to dispatch a lawyer to Cowell's courtroom to oppose Ferreria's action, whatever it was. Cochran assigned young associate Sean Chapman. On July 15, she sat outside the judge's chambers while Ferreria, Cowell, and a dignified African-American man of about 30 conferred in the presence of a court stenographer. At the end of the ex parte proceeding, Judge Cowell advised Chapman that Ferreria's confidential information was indeed important and relevant. He said that he'd given the DA's office 10 days to complete its own investigation and then would disclose the mystery information to the Pratt side. 2 weeks later, a packet of material arrived in Hanlon's office in the Haight. He scanned the cover sheet and told his secretary to hold his calls. After reading the second page, he locked his door. Then he dialed his occasional sparring partner. "Brent," he said, "what was that remark you made about me making a big thing out of this?" "Brent, the whole world's gonna make a big thing out of this. Everybody but you and Harry Sondheim." The unidentified man, whom Sean Chapman had seen entering Judge Cowell's chambers, turned out to be Brian Hale, a senior investigator for the DA's office. In May, Garcetti had assigned him and his colleague Steve DePrima to investigate all angles of the Pratt case in preparation for opposing Pratt's latest petition. One of their first acts was to interview Julius Butler. With Deputy DAs Sondheim and Ferreria sitting in on the session, DePrima asked Butler if he'd ever been paid as an informant by any law enforcement agency. Butler admitted that several months before testifying against Pratt, someone in the DA's office had given him money to buy a gun. At first, the lawyer and churchman refused to identify his benefactor. "I don't want to get a friend in trouble," but later he named Morris Bowles, the DA's detective who'd been assigned to assist Richard Kaloustian during the Pratt trial. Butler said he used the money to buy a .357 Magnum and admitted that he'd carried the weapon for the next 10 years in violation of California law. After Butler split a few more hairs over the definition of informer, "I wasn't an informer. I was doing liaison." Investigator Hale took the routine step of asking the DA's Bureau of Investigation to check its informer files. A captain opened a locked drawer, looked under B, and extracted three confidential informant cards on Julius Carl Butler. The name Bowles was written in ink on each. Footnote 68. In a statement later, Morris Bowles suggested that the former beautician was covering up for someone else. He emphatically denied that he prepared the CI cards or put them in the confidential informant file. End of footnote. The cards were dated January 27, 1972, 6 months before Geronimo Pratt had gone on trial for murder. The head of the DA's intelligence unit said that the card file was maintained for the use of prosecutors who might need the information while trying cases. The discovery was a double victory for the Pratt team. It confirmed in writing what the lawyers had been saying about Butler for two decades, and it effectively swept the FBI complications from the case. Hanlon explained, "No state judge wants to hear anything about the FBI. No state judge wants to challenge the FBI. The special agents do their little song and dance in the judge's chambers, shake a little secret information out of their sleeves, and the next thing you know, you've lost your case and you don't know why." COINTELPRO agents acted like the Gestapo in the Pratt case, but every time we tried to bring this out in the courtroom, it just caused confusion and doubt. Now that we had Julius Butler dead to rights as a DA's informer, the FBI stuff was out of it. We had a pure California case with California issues and California players. It narrowed the focus. He phoned Cochran in Los Angeles and said, "There's the smoking gun we've been looking for. I wonder why that informer information was still in the files. Why didn't they purge it?" Footnote 69. When Ronald Mouse, one time acting chief of the DA's Bureau of Investigation, was asked why Butler's card and some 600 others hadn't been purged like thousands of other old documents in the DA's records, he answered, "They were the sacred cards. They stayed there. They were very important. They pertained to people that provided information, and they, the informants, could be in jeopardy should that information get out." End of footnote. Garcetti's head must be spinning. Brian Hale isn't the kind of guy who's gonna compromise himself, Cochran replied. When he found those cards, he gave his superiors no choice. They had to turn them over or risk jail. It's nice to have a guy like Hale around. When Hanlon told Mark Rosenbaum the latest news, The ACLU lawyer said, "This is it, Stu," he said. "We've won." "Mark," Hamlin replied, "you know the history. This case is different." "It may be different," Rosenbaum said, "but this new stuff is devastating. All these years, Kalustian's been denying that Butler was an informant. How can he say he didn't know?" "Well, that's exactly what he is saying." In the California legal newspaper, The Daily Journal, staff writer Martin Berg quoted Kalustian, "I had no knowledge of any informant card, and I had no knowledge of any gun. None. Zero." Later, he amplified, "I had no knowledge that the Bureau of Investigation had a confidential informant index card file that contained a card with Julius Butler's name on it. I had no knowledge that any employee of the district attorney's office ever gave Julius Butler money. I never gave Julius Butler any money. I never gave Julius Butler a gun, nor did I give him any aid in obtaining a concealed weapons permit. Julius Butler never received any leniency in return for his testimony in the Pratt case. Many years after the case was over, I did help Julius Butler with a prior conviction in order to aid him in obtaining admission to law school." A week after investigator Brian Hale's bombshell went off in the Los Angeles press, a billboard appeared above a McDonald's restaurant on Century Boulevard. "An innocent man in prison for 26 years. Geronimo Pratt. Los Angeles. How long must he wait for justice?" An anonymous donor had paid $60,000 to rent the space and sent along a matching check for legal expenses. Similar signs popped up at bus shelters near the criminal court's building. Jim McCloskey reported from Princeton that other donors were asking how they could help. "Don't tell me somebody's finally gonna help with court costs," Hamlin said. "We'll lose our amateur standing." The contributions were set aside for legal expenses. At a bail hearing on August 14, Superior Court Judge Michael Cowell sent another set of mixed signals. Hamlin had argued that the smoking gun evidence justified Pratt's release on bail, but after a long semantical argument about the difference between a snitch and an informant, the judge ruled that Mr. Pratt is not eligible for bail. As matters now stand, he is convicted of the crime of murder. Cowell also commented, "Mr. Butler was directly an informant to the district attorney's office. We also have information that Mr. Butler had indicated that either money and or a gun was provided to him by a representative of the district attorney's office. He did not designate Mr. Kalustian. And while I agree with you that the question of his informant status is important, there is also an additional issue that comes into play, and that is, regardless of the impact of his testimony, to what extent is the decision of the court to be guided by the fact that money was provided to an informant without that fact in and of itself being disclosed to the defendant? In other words, even if Butler's testimony was truthful, his status as an informant is something the defendant is entitled to be notified of at the time of the trial." "Well, yes, Your Honor," Hamlin said to himself, "that's exactly what we've argued for years. 5 weeks later, the Pratt lawyers met for breakfast in the cafeteria of the criminal court's building. When court convened, they intended to ask Cowell to stop temporizing and set a firm date for an evidentiary hearing. After a bad night of motel sleep, Hanlon arrived minutes late and said, "I got a feeling the judge is going to throw us out of L.A." Juliana Drouse agreed. Sean Chapman, Cochran's associate, said that she'd heard the same rumor, but it couldn't be true. "Cowell's already tried to get rid of us," she said. "He wouldn't dare try again." But none of the Pratt attorneys anticipated Judge Cowell's next step in the judicial maneuverings, even after he began rationalizing his decision aloud. To another packed courtroom, he explained that his judicial colleague, Richard Kaloustian's involvement as a possible witness had altered the tone of the case. "Why, you're attacking a sitting judge," he told the Pratt lawyers. He held up a recent issue of California Lawyer magazine and read, "Cochran makes no secret of his intention to destroy Kaloustian's character." Cowell claimed that the ad hominem attack on a fellow Los Angeles judge left him no choice but to recuse himself. But he also disqualified the entire Los Angeles bench. The case would be returned to the State Judicial Council in San Francisco for reassignment, a process that could take months. A newly assigned judge might simply dismiss the petition. Outside the courtroom, Hanlon aimed a hard slap at the wall. "What rock has this judge been living under?" he raged to reporters. "We've been accusing Kaloustian of putting on perjured testimony since 1977. There's nothing new about it. He's just looking for an excuse. He's afraid to make hard decisions." Deputy DA Brentford Ferreria passed by, and Hanlon said, "Wipe off that grin, Brent. This might go to San Francisco. That's my backyard." Ferreria commented that Bay Area hotels were expensive. "I have a room in my basement," Hanlon said. "You can stay down there with the other rats." The friendly enemies bantered back and forth until Ferreria said he would yield to Hanlon's expertise. "My expertise?" Hanlon said. "On what?" "On rats." 2 more months of pachydermis waltzing passed before the Judicial Council made an unexpected announcement of its own. The Pratt matter was assigned to Orange County for a full evidentiary hearing. Hanlon felt as though he'd been blackjacked. Orange County, bordering Los Angeles to the south, was Nixon and Reagan country. It had a strong military-industrial base, a history of electing conservatives, and a diminished African-American presence. Hanlon phoned Cochran. "We got transferred to Santa Ana." Cochran sputtered, "That's Orange County?" "I don't know how they did it, but the fix is still in." Cochran said, "I'll tell you how they did it. The DA's office has clout and we don't." He paused. "Who's going to tell Geronimo?" "I'd rather eat glass." "Well, you're 300 miles closer to Mule Creek." Hanlon guessed that settled the argument. He found his client oddly indifferent to the bad news. "Orange County, L.A. County, Disneyland, Yosemite Park, wherever, Geronimo said. What's the difference? I'm sorry, G, Hanlon said. We had high hopes this time. Yep, weren't we stupid? Geronimo said he was expecting a visit from his brother Timothy. He didn't seem excited about it. Tim always wants to talk religion. Driving home, Hanlon thought, my old friend is slipping, showing signs of being beaten down, whipped, and it only took a quarter of a century.
Context of white supremacy. So that is our first audio segment. We'll pick up the next section, The Orange Curtain. Bonus points if anyone has seen the documentary, Black Behind the Orange Curtain. Cowbell. Anywho, before I proceed, it's just been on my mind, very, very unpleasant, challenging period of time. We talked about it yesterday. Dr. Ruby's father passed away, and just she's been here a number of times, so that is still weighing heavily on my thoughts. I just hope that she and her family are doing as best they can, eating well, nourishing themselves, and fondly remembering her father. That said, for our book club today, the number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. The email is untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com if you want to write in thoughts, observations. We had some folks write in who observed, hey, they're talking about releasing COINTELPRO information right now. And we talked about some of that with Bobby E. Rush, Congressman Bobby Rush, former Panther member, last week, that is happening right now in the comps of Congress. They're talking about that. I have a sound clip. We'll get to that as well. And then we have folks who wrote in, some of our investors who dropped a line. Let's see. All right. Number one, Media Blitz. Cochran emitted one of his patented horse laughs when Hanlon recounted the conversation. This may have been an element of black misandry, comparing Cochran to a horse, in addition to a Welsing moment of racialized sexual symbolism, the proverbial black stallion. I could be wrong. Interesting. I would definitely say with the horse, yeah, that seems pretty easy. I don't know what his patented horse. I've heard Johnny Cochran laugh before, so. The sexual symbolism, we'll put a pin in that and come back to it. The sexual stallion, we've heard that before, right? We'll come back to that, or keep that in mind as we continue through the reading today. Next, substantial issue. Number one, Cochran was coldly realistic. I once won a murder case in Cowles Court, but he still makes me nervous. Johnny Cochran, being a non-white victim, I am sure had a wealth of experience with disappointment with the so-called criminal justice system. Absolutely. Confidential informant. Number one, the mid-June Harry Sondheim filed a 113-page brief arguing that Pratt's request for a new trial was speculative, groundless, and unwarranted. Using buckets and buckets of words is tactical for suspected racists. 113 pages worth of buckets. We'll stop there as we're getting close to Orange County. There are so many comparisons with O.J. Simpson in this case, and maybe even Nelson Mandela too, but with O.J. Simpson specifically, the L.A. Times has tons of daily coverage, round-the-clock coverage, if you will, of the O.J. Simpson trial. They have a lot of coverage of the Geronimo Pratt trial as well. It's pretty liberally quoted throughout the text. I've posted quite a few different reports that kind of go almost day by day, especially as it gets closer to when Pratt is eventually released in 97. They have lots and lots of reports. So if you really want to do some investigating, and in fact, the audio segment that we started with today from Democracy Now!, Stuart Hanlon was there. Ed Boyer was also a guest on that program. He wrote for the LA Times. And they had one other person who also did a lot of writing for the LA Times. But they have a lot of information. You can go back and get even more details if you want to learn about this case. COINTELPRO, Johnny Cochran, lots of details. I think I mentioned it already, the McMartin case. It was mentioned last week in PR. They had that big segment this week. It was like a 10-minute report, and a lot of it they talked about the McMartin case and how that was such a huge tabloid event of the 1980s and all the rest of it, and how that's related to the whole QAnon conspiracy now. Definitely worth checking out. Our timing has been, something to behold once again with the book club. Okay, we'll get the phone lines, and then I'll make sure to include the audio segment of Congressman Bobby Rush, news clip out of Chicago, on what they had to say about the COINTELPRO operation as well. Number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. First, few folks dialed in. If you have commentary to share, retired firefighter, and then we'll nab other hands as I see them. You should be with us, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everybody. First, start off with page 361, where it says Marlon Brando, Sean Penn, and other Hollywood celebrities issued statements, complaints, reached the death of U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. I'm familiar with all of these personalities. Marlon Brando was always somewhere around when it came to the Black Panther Party, in my opinion, for the wrong reasons. When it came down to it, with the whole idea of buying weapons for Black people, I would have thought it'd been much more realistic and practical if he bought weapons for white people to destroy the system of racist white supremacy, as opposed to giving Black people guns, and those guns, from my understanding, were not workable. Sean Penn, who also has been around such events, from my understanding, the FASCO that took place in Haiti, he had some wrongdoing involved into that incident that took place in the earthquake that took place in Haiti. Well, they call it an earthquake anyway. No telling what it really was. They didn't mention by name the other Hollywood celebrities, but I'm pretty sure that we will be able to mention, have a knowledge of all of those people. They normally roam around together. Janet Reno, as some people may know, she was basically promoted out of Miami. She grew up in Miami-Dade County in itself, and she was the prosecutor, I believe, and at one time the top law enforcement official in Miami-Dade County during the 1980s, and in turn during the well-known McDuffie case that took place in 1980-81. I got here on page 363. Didn't you hear what I just said about Julie? In other words, the white guy was telling someone who had been in prison for over 20 years about what's so much more important than him being in prison, and being in prison for that longer time for something that he did not do. versus a person who is going to die for sure, that could be delayed as far as that concern. He demands first priority, in my opinion. Geronimo Pratt does. Next page. I got here. I want Cochran to take. Oh yeah, from his, just to show his frustration. Because excuse me, white people, they want to get involved in these things, but at the same time, go to the standpoint of slowing down on a process of a person who is suffering in greater confinement. And so he was frustrated and stated how he wanted this guy Hanlon fired and just go in and go with Mr. Cochran. And I can like feel his anguish in the whole situation. All he ever said to do was to say, I did it. Oh, yeah. And this little sentence that I underlined, all he ever had to do was to say, I did it. I'm sorry. Geronimo never said what the parole board wanted. And that's the point is that that's the predicament a lot of people, non-white black people who are in prison for something they did not do, they have that particular reasoning, that insane reasoning, that if all they do is admit something that they didn't do, it's such a strange solution. It actually is not a solution, but I just can't figure a better word for right now on the kind of predicament they put people in to actually admit something they didn't do. I'll table my further remarks and for right now, and because I got a few more left. But go ahead with somebody else. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Just admit that you did it, and we'll let you go. If you just admit that you did it, we all know you did it. If you just admit it, we'll let you loose. That is rather common in the system of white supremacy. I think even O.J. Simpson was talk about if, he had confessed to all of this, they maybe could have looked at copping a deal and some other things. Just admit that you did it. Just admit that you did it and get rid of all these crazy charges and things and, move forward. Just admit that you did it. Let's see. While folks are getting their thoughts together, I'll give out a few of the notes. They start off the chapter with one of the terms that's in the word guide. So we were stuck in the mud. Uh-oh. System of white supremacy, that you never want to be stuck in the mud. That is way too close to Niggertown or Overtown or somewhere close to. You don't want to be around there. Don't want to be stuck in the mud in the system of white supremacy. Let's see. So they're going into more of the details right off the beginning about Butler and having a district attorney who's finagling getting his fines for the case reduced and all that. Now compare that. Kalustian gets Julio Butler's fines reduced to what he'd already paid, $80, as opposed to right now you got the governor in Florida saying, oh, no. They already voted. Democracy, they say. They voted and say, hey, we're restoring voting rights to felons and all that. This is ridiculous. We want to fully participatory democracy. Governor DeSantis said, nah. You haven't paid those fine backs. No way. Get out of that voting booth. We'll yank you out by your ear. Pay those fine backs. Pay those fines back. As opposed to, fines paid. Good community servant like Mr. Butler here. Then they come down. Let's see. Wow, I can't even imagine. So the first AME pastor, Reverend Cecil L. Chip Murray, now, he's already supported a new trial for Mr. Pratt. Now he's the leader of a 3,500-member group of black males, presumably. They support Julio Butler. Lots of conflict now. That right there, I don't know Julio Butler personally, but I mean, as we continue to read, it's going to become, I think, pretty obvious. Mr. Butler was an informant, so he's a victim of white supremacy, but I don't know that I'm going to be out in the rally like, save Julio Butler. That's my dude. He didn't lie. Lots of confusion, lots of non-white people not really understanding racism, white supremacy. And I could add, too, it might have been Julio Butler's awesome, that he helped these guys out and did a lot of wonderful things in the church and in the area. That could totally be true. So they could have very valid reasons for why they were, sticking with Mama. Wasn't that his nickname, Julio Butler, said way, way back in the book? Maybe they had valid reasons why they were, sticking behind him in spite of. I guess I also would be remiss, if he was still functioning in his role as an informer and you're in the middle of a congregation with 3,000 members who are maybe all black or predominantly black, what a lifelong asset. But maybe he wasn't doing that anymore. Let's see. They mentioned CBS Evening News, their feature Eye on America that told the story of Geronimo Pratt. I'm trying to see if I can locate that on YouTube or somewhere in internet land. I think they have the Fox TV special on YouTube. I think I've watched that. I think I've seen that. That was pretty good. Let's see. Next. I want to try to get the Gentleman's Quarterly article, the other case that obsesses Johnny Cochran. Again, if UW libraries were open, I would have probably already had that report and posted it. But those days are coming. Let's see. Yeah, retired firefighter mentioned all the white celebrities who put their names along with this case. We've heard Marlon Brando mentioned a bunch in the book club. White Dog, remember that? He was mentioned every other page there, too. Let's see. They get to... When he gets to this point where they have the exchange, Hanlon and Geronimo Pratt, and Geronimo is upset with them, like, you all are messing around and you're not filing briefs on time. And Hanlon's like, hey, Julie Trouse, her mom's dying. She's stressed out. It's going to be a little bit late. I'm remembering it was just last week where Hanlon was late filing a brief and it got tossed out because he missed the deadline where he said, well, usually this wouldn't be a big deal, but this time they did make a big deal, make a stink about it and toss the filing out because it was late. If I've been in prison 20 years, forget that, if I've been in greater confinement for 2 days and it seems like my lawyer is missing deadlines and snorting cocaine and whatever else as we go through this process, I'm going to be a little impatient as well. What in the world? Get your act together, man. I'm in here could be killed and raped and eating gruel and all the rest of it. You all are messing around. Get it together, man. And then when he says Pratt says you all are making me look bad. I got commitments. He's like, commitments with who? He says Africa. All kinds of people, man. Asia. You all are making me look bad. And he's like, what are you talking about? You're reading your own press and you're losing it. You don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Number one, I thought they said he did move to Tanzania after this was over. So he probably did have contacts on the continent. They did have Black Panthers that went to the continent. I think they had at least one Black Panther chapter on the continent. I'm sure defunct now, but at the time, back in the 70s and what have you, I'm sure he may have easily had contacts with Joseph Mobutu, Nelson Mandela, Joseph Tutu, Desmond Tutu, excuse me. It wouldn't surprise me at all if he had contact with these people or folks who are related to them, whatever the case may be, where, yeah, you're messing around and these folks he's got major people who are involved in his case all over the world. So it would seem sensible to me, not like, oh man, who is this guy? And he's just going crazy and thinking all, you know, self-absorbed and arrogant, like he's so important and all the rest. Like, no, I think it's very feasible. He might have had contact with some of these folks. And his lawyers being tardy in getting things filed. Let's see. He gets to... Yeah, he says this must be some kind of synaptic misfire. G had been having more of them lately. I just thought that was really dismissive and perhaps even an act of deliberate act of white supremacy racism, where it just can't be that you have legitimate concerns as a wrongly accused caged inmate victim. And then on top of that, the lawyers have been leaked in getting things filed, handling specifically. And then you're being tardy again. Whether you got justification, death in the family, or whatever it is, like, man, come on, stop pussy. That's going to come up again. Stop pussyfooting with all this. Let's see. I've remembered now last week we had the incident where the guards threw the lawyers out because of potato chips, right? So we got rules here. Can't just be eating potato chips here in the prison. Why do you have the machine here? And they got the cigarette smoking machine and they got no problem there. Smoke all the cigarettes and death sticks you want, right? Who's most to blame for all the cigarette addiction? How'd that cigarette machine get in there in the first place, right? Let's see. Horse laugh, we talked about that. Let's see. The word fair was used tons in this week's section. My goodness. Lots of Gil Garcetti coming to the fore now. Let's see. Let's see. Thought Johnny Cochran was correct to be suspicious. Buckets of words from Sondheim. Sean Chapman. So I said, I'm so glad we read O.J. Simpson first and then followed it with this. People should remember these names, right? Sean Chapman, O.J. Simpson, Gil Garcetti. People should remember all of these folks. I didn't know they were going to step in so forcefully as we go down the stretch. You're like, oh, wow, that's the whole gang from way back when. We just need to get Jeffrey Toobin in here and we could do it all over again. Let's see. So she's there when they see, like, oh my goodness, they've got this guy who's worked for the police. And now he knows, Brian Hale, he knows, or he's an investigator for the DA's office. And he's found out, Julius Butler's on this index card listed as an informer. Like, oh my goodness, yikes. And even this whole process, it's not even like they can't just come out and say, oh, we found information that he was listed as an informant. Whoops. Nah, we got to drag that out, and that'll take a few more weeks before we let you know that, and then we'll make a decision about that. Like, man, he could have been killed. Anything could have happened in this long, lengthy process. Let's see. And then you talk about buckets of words. Then they do the same thing going around again over informer. And what's an informer? Or I'm not a snitch. Or no, and all this other, I'm a liaison, and all this other goofiness. Let's see. Deception, excuse me, be correct. Let's see. Anything else? I thought it was great. They talked about this repeatedly, and they have pictures of some of these billboards, placards, where they protested. People came out and protested all throughout the O.J. Simpson trial for a lot of things, but people also used it to protest the Geronimo Pratt case as well, which I thought was awesome. And then the continued protests on afterwards, especially as they would get new information, like, oh, you got cards saying Butler's an informant and all the rest of it. You can see some of the placards online. Let's see. Yeah, I'll stop. I think we talked about this last week because you get to the end of the chapter. And Hanlon says, my old friend is slipping, showing signs of being beaten down, whipped, and it only took a quarter of a century. Like, man, you've been sleeping in feces and waste. And then they deny everything. Like, I don't know. The best you could do to stay alive and just stay in good spirits and not go totally crazy, as opposed to having some sort of hope that some white person behind the bench is going to do the correct thing. Like, I would have given up hope on that a long time ago just by the conduct that he's observed for a quarter century. I'll double check, see if other folks have thoughts that they want to make sure they share. It wasn't included in the section that we just read, but it's coming up in the section that we're about to cover. Everything that we know about O.J. Simpson trial and, 25, 26 years out, the hatred, right, that a lot of suspected racists have for Johnny Cochran Jr., even to this day, would that be enough as to one might think, hey, if we really want Geronimo Pratt to get out of prison, maybe we don't want to have Johnny Cochran on the team. Like, the judge might have a flashback and, have round two and, just have this nigger that goes around getting off, white woman killing niggers, no way. Not going to have it. That Cochran dude is not going to win another one in a white man's courtroom or a white woman's courtroom. That type of thinking, right, might be prevalent. So people can think about this. I'll go ahead and get in our segment with Congressman Bobby Rush as people get any other thoughts together. This is just from literally a couple days ago, him talking, hey, we need to release all of the Cointel profiles. What did you all do? Let's get all of the details. What did you do to Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, Bunchy Carter, Geronimo Pratt, Bobby Seale, David Hilliard, Bobby Hutton? What did you do? Give us all the details. What did you do? Bobby Rush, what did you do? He was in the party himself. Asada Shakur, what did you do? Dr. Afeni Shakur, what did you do? Give us all the details. This is Bobby Rush, WBEZ, Chicago.
Chicago Congressman Bobby Rush is taking aim at FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's notorious program called COINTELPRO. Agents targeted the Black Panthers and other liberation groups through that program. Rush, who is a former Black Panther, has introduced a measure that would require the public disclosure of those records. Jeffrey Haas is a lawyer who defended the Black Panthers. He also wrote a book about how the FBI and Chicago police killed local party chairman Fred Hampton. Haas sat down with WBEZ's Natalie Moore.
For those who don't know, tell us about how COINTELPRO got started and the damage it did to political movements.
Well, COINTELPRO got started late in the 50s, and its original target was a lot the Communist Party, but it spread. Its main target became the Black movement. And by the late 60s, its biggest target was the Black Panther Party. It was a secret program that Hoover devised. And the idea was to subvert various left organizations and left leaders. And there was a burglary at an FBI office in 1971 that exposed the existence of the program. And subsequently, Hoover stopped the program. But by then, we discovered all these internal documents that talked about prevent the rise of a Black Messiah who could unify and electrify the masses, which is the mandate we think they were operating on in Chicago when they killed Fred Hampton.
What would Congressman Rush's bill do? Like, how much more do you think is out there?
I think there's a lot more, particularly both details with regard to the Fred raid and the cover-up, but also the higher-ups' involvement. It's very difficult when you try to get an FBI file if you don't name the file. If you don't call it the Fred Hampton file or the Black Panther file, then they don't give it to you. So it's hard to estimate what's out there. But I think there's some pretty damning stuff, particularly we know how much Hoover was afraid of everything that people of color did, everything that the left did. I mean, if we know that Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X would have been a target, Stokely Carmichael was a target. Dr. King was a target. So I think we could assume that there were many other people on whom there are many files. And I think also, I think what Congressman Rush is trying to uncover is, well, what the complete program, what it did, and what are its current iterations today? We saw at Ferguson and Standing Rock a tremendous collusion between government forces and private security. We also see a tremendous increase or accuracy of surveillance equipment.
Why does the country need these records to be public?
I think it's really important to know what the government really does. You know, we have a constitutional right to organize. We have a right to assemble. We have a right to do redress our government. And we have a right to know what they may be doing to stop legitimate First Amendment protest and even civil disobedience, which is aimed at obtaining human rights and dealing with wrongs. Most of the progress in this country has come from people in the streets or raising issues, whether it's the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the gay movement, the anti-war movement around Vietnam. These things should not be, because they are disagree with U.S. policies, should not be targets of government infiltration, government harassment, and government destruction, or in the case of Fred Hampton, government murder.
Context of white supremacy. As I said, that was just from like literally the beginning of this week, like 3-4 days ago. They aired that WBEZ, exactly what we're talking about with the book club. And I will just repeat what Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly said. Again, Dr. Welsing encouraged us to read his book, Racial Matters, the FBI's Secret, that word again, file on Black America. They didn't say people of color. Black, they didn't say left. Black America from 1960 to 1972. He said, yes, every single person that he mentioned for sure has a robust file. Muhammad Ali, Stokely Carmichael, Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, Dr. Martin Luther King. Yep. Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly said it was any individual classified as black is a suspect, potential threat, because your loyalties are suspect. We already know you're niggerized. You're treated like garbage, his exact words. You're treated like trash. So your loyalties are suspect. You might want to do something, try to solve this here problem at some point. So got to keep an eye on you, keep tabs on you. What are you up to? Who are you talking to? What are you reading? You know about Neely Fuller, Dr. Welsing, Dr. Kanban? Who are you talking to? That type of thing. Why you might need a Julius Butler to keep tabs on who's at the church and what they're talking about, or who's at the barbershop, what they're talking about, what they're doing. Very important indeed. Let's see. Any other commentary folks want to make sure they get in on this section, or you can push off to audio section number 2?
Yes, Gus, right quick. Comments that was made by, I believe it was a white female, Jean Hamilton, in the court appearance, saying that she was scared to death, and she wanted to apologize for, as a juror, I guess, she helped send, Geronimo to prison, you know, that white guilt thing. Just to show you on how, by having elected officials in the court systems, and it's based on whether or not how this person is going to get elected again, as opposed to something on a base of correctness and what's correct and what's just. That goes somewhere else other than what it should be, and based on somebody getting elected, and that puts a person in prison for 26 years. And the last thing I wanted to say is the last comment that was made by Geronimo when he said his brother, I believe, liked to talk about religion, on why something like that is something that we want to, as victims of racism, white supremacy, want to stay away from, talking about religion. Besides, if if this religion understanding that we have is so good, how come we're always the victims of racism and white supremacy? That has to be examined on what how we have understanding of religious things. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I think that's going to come up again this week before we conclude. Having some sort of code in terms of talking about religion or not in order to minimize conflict. Seems like Geronimo Pratt has that one down, like minimize conflict. Everybody, they're in greater confinement or not, minimize conflict. Like if there is going to be some conflict, then be cursing out your lawyer. Be that way with somebody who is a suspected racist, but minimize conflict in greater confinement, minimize conflict with family members. I'm not going to be fussing with them and talking about religion all the time, and have a code. Very important. A code to minimize conflict. Very important. Let's see. Anything else? Let me make sure I get in before we push off to the second. I guess make sure they ponder that, because that is going to come up explicitly in the second audio segment. So knowing what you know about Orenthal James and how white people feel about he, Johnny L. Cochran Jr., if you're a black person, you got a court case. It is now after 1995. Do you want Johnny Cochran in the courtroom, especially if it's closer to 1995, like January 96, beginning of 97? Do you want Johnny L. Cochran Jr. with you in the courtroom, or do you think there could be a white lash where got that flashy talking slick dressing nigra again, like he's not gonna OJ Simpson up the, I don't care what the evidence is, like do you that might be something to consider. We will hear it in a few minutes. We will hear it, but that might be something to consider if you are a black person. System of white supremacy, even with the brilliance of Johnny L. Cochran Jr., like we white people might have it out for him. Like, in fact, that is something I'd be interested to hear. Like, did he get that sense after the O.J. Simpson trial, at least for the first few years? Did he feel like folks were out to get him, or he just went about doing his job? No big difference. Because he kept a pretty full slate of clients. So anyway, let's see. Anything else? Sean Chapman. Other names that should be familiar from the O.J. Simpson trial will creep in as we roll. I think that's good for now. I'll save anything. If any other folks, if you had any additional thoughts and you didn't get to share, make a note. We will have ample time, and we are on the home stretch. I think we should have two more sessions, and we are all done. Last man standing, we can push off to a different book. But going down, last few segments, at least we'll have this week and then a couple more. But Jack Olson's Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Gijaga Pratt. Context of White Supremacy, this is our second audio segment. Chapter 58, The Orange Curtain. Early reports about Orange County Superior Court Judge Everett Dickey were disheartening. He was described as a Reagan appointee, a right-wing Republican, ex-military, a 62-year-old health freak who ran his court like a drill sergeant and sometimes jogged with his staff at lunchtime. "We've got a redneck judge in a fascist county," Hanlon protested to Julie Drouse. The only encouraging sign in Dickey's advance profile came via a friendly lawyer, Milton Grimes. "I asked Milton about Judge Dickey," Cochran told Hanlon by phone. "All he said was, the guy's been a judge for 26 years. He's a conservative, but he's got guts." "Great," Hanlon said. "So did General Patton." The two colleagues discussed another sticky problem. the Simpson case had made Cochran the most controversial lawyer in the United States. Would he be a liability in Orange County? It's a legitimate concern, Johnny, Hanlon said, feeling guilty. He also suspected that Cochran might be overbooked after the trial of the century. He was negotiating a TV deal with Court TV, publicizing his book, Journey to Justice, and handling his usual overload of cases. Of course, it's a legitimate concern, Stu, Cochran replied, and you'd be remiss if you didn't address it. You know how I feel, Hanlon said. You know how I feel, too. Why don't you guys talk it over? I don't want to do anything that would hurt Geronimo. It would break my heart to drop out, but it's your call. After Judge Dickey set November 22, 1996, as a status hearing, Hanlon discussed the Cochran effect with the other strategists, Jim McCloskey, Julie Drouse, Mark Rosenbaum, Robert Garcia, a few of Hanlon's trusted friends, and his personal advisor, his wife, Kathy Ryan. By phone from Princeton, McCloskey admitted that he saw a downside. The judge might take the attitude, "We'll show Mr. Hotshot from L.A. who's boss around here," but I think it's worth the risk. Hanlon described other reactions later. Some of our people saw Johnny as a slick, jiving guy who would bring out the wrong persona to Orange County, especially if the judge turned out to be a racist. They said the judge might be intimidated or pissed, and the whole hearing would focus on Johnny. The judge might say, "This is a guy who got a murderer off. I'll fix his ass. I let all my friends have their say, and then I made a little speech. I said, I've been dealing with Johnny Cochran for 20 years. He has never lost interest in this case. He has never failed to do everything he promised to do. Sure, he brings some negative PR, but he'll bring negative PR whether he's in court or not. The Pratt case will forever be associated with Johnny Cochran." I let that sink in, and then I said, "Oh yeah, and one other thing, he's a goddamn fine courtroom lawyer." Hanlon phoned Chicago, where Cochran was in the home stretch on a 42-city book tour. "Johnny," he said, "we talked it over. We need you. I know you're busy." "You can't keep me out, Stu," Cochran said. "You'll be co-counsel?" "I demand to be co-counsel." They decided that Hanlon and the team members would continue their work on preliminary matters and Cochran would join them for the evidentiary hearing. "I can't wait to question Julio under oath," he said. "Get in line, Johnny," Hanlon said. "I've wanted a piece of that guy for years. I've wanted a piece of him ever since he lied to me in court. You were a college kid then." They agreed to share the questioning. Hanlon and Julie Drouse arrived in Orange County for the status hearing and were quickly reminded of their distance from the Golden Gate. The local airport was named after John Wayne, and a statue of the conservative avatar looked down on them as they disembarked. "Welcome to Marlborough County, Jules," Hanlon cracked. You ain't in Haight-Ashbury no more. Drouse touched her finger to her lips. Shh, we're behind the orange curtain. That night, she phoned an old friend, Don Ayub, a local lawyer who'd provided wise counsel in the past. After the conversation, she told Hanlon, Don says Judge Dickey might surprise us. He's a conservative, but he's one of those conservatives who actually believe in the Constitution. Dickey had defeated a recall move for his light sentencing of two Latino killers and for nullifying the conviction of a child murderer on grounds of jury misconduct, two unlikely actions by a supposed right-winger. A prosecutor had described him as ruthlessly fair. You mean we got a judge who plays it straight? Hanlon said. I'm not sure I'm up for anything that weird. Ayub says everybody gets a fair hearing in Dickey's court. On his flight from Washington to Los Angeles, Timothy Pratt offered up silent prayers of thanks that he would soon see his younger brother. A small-town California talk show hostess had interviewed Tim by phone and learned that he seldom visited Geronimo because of the travel expense. 3 days later, the woman had called to inform him that her listeners had bought him the ticket. Virginia Pratt, still teaching problem children in the ghetto, met her brother at the Los Angeles airport and drove him to the jail in Santa Ana. On the way, they recalled the Halloween night when she'd sprinted through the streets of Across the Tracks to threaten Tim's attackers with a gun. You saved my life, Jenny, he said. Then how come you never visit? She joked. Guards allowed brother and sister a 2-hour meeting with Geronimo in the public visiting room. I missed you all, he told them. How I miss Mama. Timothy was tempted to share his vision that God had sent him as an emissary of good news, but he held back. Geronimo didn't like to talk religion. Chapter 59, Enigma in Robes. After the Pratt lawyers took their first look at the imposing figure of Judge Dickey, they weren't sure what to think. His bailiff called the courtroom to order with a personalized announcement that included a pin to the flag of our country, symbol of the Constitution. As if on cue, His Honor strode from a side door, squaring his corners and arranging himself on his high-backed leather chair with the stiffness of a West Point cadet. He had the ruddy look of someone who just toweled off after a swim. He wore a neatly cropped white mustache and a meticulously coiffed crown of rich wavy hair the color of mother-of-pearl. He arranged some papers and looked down his long patrician nose with an expression that suggested he was coping with an unusual smell. Hanlon asked himself, what the hell is this? The proceedings had hardly begun before Dickey announced that he was fully conversant with the paperwork in the case and intended to place strict limits on the evidentiary hearing. Hanlon suppressed a groan. 10 years earlier, U.S. Magistrate John Cronenberg had issued the same warning. In an authoritarian tone, Dickey made it plain that he wanted to hear all the facts from both sides, but would be reluctant to listen to any testimony or argument about COINTELPRO or the FBI. the issues of informers on Cochran's legal team in 1972 would also be taboo. Matters that had been adjudicated in other courts would not be remasticated. Hanlon thought, what the hell does this guy intend to hear? The answer came down from the bench. I particularly want to deal with the informant issue. Was Mr. Butler an informant? If so, I want to find out who knew that he was an informant and when did they know it? I believe that is a main issue here. Julie Drouse passed Hanlon a note. Exclamation marks. The judge continued. There has to be some clarification on what efforts were made by Mr. Kaloustian on Mr. Butler's behalf. I think we have to hear from Detective Bowles. He said that the DA's investigators claim that he didn't remember how Butler's name got into the informer file is not good enough. The judge wondered aloud why the information about the file is only being disclosed now, 24 years later, and added, it's clear that this is not a typical case. It cries out for resolution. He also reminded the lawyers that an evidentiary hearing was different from a trial, that the rules gave the judge wide latitude, and that he intended to seek the truth wherever he had to look. If that entailed disregarding some of his own strictures, so be it. When Dickey asked about potential witnesses, Hanlon announced his intention of calling Butler. Several LAPD officers and Superior Court Judge Richard Kaloustian. Harry Sondenheim registered a strong objection and Hanlon held his breath. In the long history of the case, no court had ever permitted the Pratt team to call such key figures. Dickey dismissed the deputy DA's objection with a wave of his hand. We're seeking the truth here, counsel, he said. You'll have cross-examination. Hanlon considered the contrast between this judge and the Superior Court bench in Los Angeles. This guy could develop into a pain in the ass, he said to himself, but he's an equal opportunity pain in the ass. He's no more impressed by these arrogant prosecutors than he is by Julie and me. This is like going to court in Lapland. Now, as to our calendar, the judge was saying, I would like to move this case right along. Without asking for suggestions, he announced that the evidentiary hearing would open on December 16. Sondheim argued for more time. That's only 3 weeks from now, Your Honor. We have witnesses to locate. Some are missing, some are dead. This matter goes back to 1970. Hanlon got the impression that the prosecutors had been caught off guard, that they'd expected a quick win by judicial fiat or, at the least, a continuance over the holidays. In the same flat voice, Dickey informed the prosecutor that he was fully cognizant of all relevant dates in the case, and if he could be ready in 3 weeks, so could the litigants. Hanlon entered a mild demurrer for the record. Your Honor, he said, I hate to agree with the DA, and we would like to move this case along too, but it's the Christmas season. Some of us have kids and family. I understand, Counselor, the judge said. I also understand that you asked for a prompt hearing. Your client's been incarcerated since December 10, 1970. You claim he's being held illegally. That's what habeas corpus is all about. My calendar is open and we will proceed as scheduled. After a few mumbled words, Hanlon backed off. The hell with it, he said to himself. I won't irritate the guy before the case even gets started. The DA's been playing stall ball for 3 years. A quick hearing will be a lot tougher on them. Co-counsel Robert Garcia, the NAACP lawyer, made a humanitarian request. Judge, can't the courtroom be dark on Christmas Eve? After some thought, Dickey granted the concession. Then he gaveled the session to a close and returned to his chambers, squaring all corners as he left. The Los Angeles Times quoted a pleased Jim McCloskey, "This is what we've been waiting for to get Julius Butler on the stand. This is the first time that Butler is going to be held accountable for his sins of the past." Hanlon strode past the statue of John Wayne and boarded an evening flight to San Francisco International Airport, where Kathy waited to drive him home. He'd felt guilty about leaving her to take care of their sons while she was also running a law practice that was every bit as stressful as his. On the drive home, he said, "It's gonna be tough over Christmas." "As long as it helps G," she said. "He's the one." "Yeah, yeah, I know. He's the one doing the time." It was her regular litany. He said, "Why don't you come down to Santa Ana for the hearing? We can use another good lawyer. You can bring the kids. That'll be their Christmas vacation." "We'll see," Kathy responded. It was her all-purpose answer to her three male dependents. Chapter 60, Cream Cheese and Potato Salad. O.J. Simpson's chief defense attorney terminated his book tour 2 weeks early and flew to Los Angeles to rejoin the Pratt team. The other members had checked into a Marriott hotel at Irvine, convenient to the courthouse in Santa Ana, and a 20-minute freeway hop to Cochran's office on Wilshire Boulevard. Johnny put his staff and his office at our disposal, Hanlon said later. What a layout! One suite after another, two conference rooms, a big library, a kitchen, long hall with placards and awards and pictures of him with Martin Luther King, Thurgood Marshall, three or four presidents. It was the only all-black law office I'd ever seen. From the receptionist to the other partners, every person you saw was African American. I thought, how fitting. G's in prison because he's black. After several meetings in the Wilshire office, Cochran took Hanlon aside and showed him an oil painting by Andrew Loomis that hung in a place of honor on a conference room wall. It depicted a black convict sprawled inside a tiny cell, his striped shirt open, his face drawn. He was throwing pieces of bread and cheese to a rat. "I saw that painting in a judge's office and I bought it on the spot," Cochran said. "To me, it was Geronimo. When we win this case and I retire, it's going home with me." At first, some of the aesthetists from Baghdad by the Bay were dismissed by Cochran's tastes in food, but the proletarian Hanlon welcomed the change. Somebody would say, "It's time to eat." "I know a great little Moroccan joint," Johnny would say. "No, no, I already sent out." pretty soon the delivery guys would show up with cold cuts, potato salad, macaroni salad, beans, cream cheese, rice pudding, chocolate cake, banana cream pie, cartons, and cartons of fattening foods. Louisiana food. One day, Jim McCloskey said, "Hey, Johnny, you forgot the chitlins." A few days into their strategy sessions, the Pratt team discovered another welcome change in the atmosphere. African-American lawmen who'd been avoiding them for years suddenly turned cooperative. Hanlon credited Cochran. His influence was overwhelming. Back in the 50s and 60s, the black law enforcement circle in Los Angeles was really small. These guys knew better than to rock the boat, so for 20 years, they gave us nada. Sergeant Dwayne Rice wouldn't even answer my phone calls, but when Sean Chapman brought him in for deposition, he treated Johnny and the rest of us like brothers. Hanlon's biggest problem was to convince his co-counsel to pace himself. Cochran always seemed involved in a dozen matters at a time. In a police abuse case, he'd won the largest jury award in L.A. history. He'd effectively ended the use of the deadly chokehold by the LAPD, won the Simpson case and other high-profile cases, and was inducted into the American College of Trial Lawyers and named Criminal Trial Lawyer of the Year. He seemed to do everything on a high-octane basis, entering the room in his own force field, jacket swirling, hand outstretched, talking fast. "Hey, great to see you. I'm so glad you're here. How can I help you today?" While longtime secretary Eloise McGill and special assistant Sonia Davis rolled their eyes in despair, he spent hours on the phone and gave out his personal numbers to strangers. "He puts off nothing," Hanlon recalled. "It has to be done right now." He and I worked out this delicate division of labor, and he always respected it. He'd been with G since 1972, but I was more active toward the end, so he put me in charge and kept it that way. His position was, "Tell me what to do and I'll do it." He kept his word. Just before the formal evidentiary hearing opened, the Pratt lawyers got a scare. Weeks earlier, Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Michael Cowell had granted the FBI's request to present uncensored reports about Geronimo Pratt in private. Technically, Cowell's ruling was still in effect. Judge Dickey seemed uncomfortable with the idea of an ex parte proceeding, but even more uncomfortable about overturning a fellow jurist's standing order. Brentford Ferreria of the DA's office presented a statement that seemed aimed at reinforcing the judge's collegial instincts. Pratt has alleged that the judge, the Honorable Kathleen Parker, now deceased, was involved in the conspiracy to convict. Pratt has attacked the Honorable Richard Calustian, judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court, and the prosecutor in this case as having withheld exculpatory evidence received from the FBI. In the most recent issue of California Lawyer, Pratt's counsel, Mr. Johnny Cochran, is quoted as saying, "I don't know if Calustian is morally capable of being a judge." Pratt claims that redacted portions of FBI documents and FBI documents that simply never existed prove that Judge Calustian put on perjured testimony. In assessing the credibility of Mr. Kaloustian, a Superior Court judge, against the credibility of Mr. Cochran, a celebrity defense lawyer, the very least the court can do is look at the FBI documents which Pratt claims contain exculpatory evidence to see if, in fact, such evidence ever existed. Hanlon bristled when he read the statement, "We've been dealing with the FBI since Coolidge was in office," he griped, "and exculpatory evidence is the last thing they're gonna show a judge. What they'll show him is every bit of dirt they can find, every unsubstantiated statement, every distortion, forgery, and fake. They'll make Geronimo look like King Kong. The FBI has shown us as much decency and fairness as your average North Beach pimp." It fell to Cochran to respond to the Ferreira statement in court. "We simply don't trust the FBI," he told the judge. He cited previous habeas corpus petitions that had been denied after cozy meetings in judicial chambers. "We're sure they'll show you disinformation and libel. At least let us look at the documents so we can point out where they're wrong." Judge Dickey said he was bound by Cowell's ruling and denied the request. After a private huddle with an FBI investigator and lawyers from the J. Edgar Hoover FBI building in Washington, he placed 1,511 secret documents under seal. Based on his own review of the government material, he said in open court, "There is nothing that completely decides this matter on the spot. In other words, there's nothing there that basically would be a smoking gun." The evidentiary hearing would proceed as scheduled. Chapter 61, Cat and Mouse. From the Pratt team's standpoint, the opening day of the hearing was memorable for a snub and a gaffe. All five lawyers, Cochran, Hanlon, Drouse, Robert Garcia, and Sean Chapman, had taken extra pains with their wardrobes. Drouse wore a new slate blue suit from Saks, and Hanlon had bought a stylish tie, shined his shoes, and carefully arranged the wispy remnants of his Jufro. Cochran wore his usual gold cross in his lapel and a surreal tie with flashy yellow streaks that matched 3 points of a golden silk handkerchief blossoming from the breast pocket of his gray pinstripe suit. Hanlon had developed a theory about Cochran's dress style. After all these years, he still has no idea what a great lawyer he is, he told his wife. He has a need to be polished, to be a fashion plate in a $5,000 suit. I think he wonders if he can do the job without all the trappings. Also, he believes in the system, and he dresses up to show his respect. "You never had that problem," Kathy said. At 8:30 a.m. on Monday, December 16, 1996, the Pratt lawyers were standing in the hall with their overloaded evidence carts when a sheriff's deputy appeared at the courtroom door and instructed the swarm of spectators, "Nobody come in. Judge says we have to do this orderly." Drouse whispered, "This is definitely not San Francisco." Behind them, the elevator doors slid open and three deputy DAs emerged. Sondheim, Ferreira, and a late addition, Jody Mitchell Link. "Right this way, counselors," the deputy called out, his eyes on the woman's long blonde hair. The three prosecutors entered the courtroom without breaking stride. "Well," Drouse explained to Sean Chapman, "they go in and we wait." Chapman couldn't resist. "And you're not even black," she said. The apparent discourtesy turned out to be a simple mistake. The judge had instructed the deputies to offer equal treatment to both sides, but the deputies hadn't seen Cochran or recognized the other members of the Pratt team. Soon, the five attorneys were politely ushered to their table. Cheers bounced off the walls of the jammed courtroom as Geronimo entered through a rear door in his canary yellow jailhouse jumpsuit with OC on the back. At 48, he'd solved the problem of his vanishing hairline by shaving his head, but he still wore a neat mustache and goatee. He smiled and waved at his supporters, including his professorial brother, Tim, and his sister, Virginia, whose own fashion statement was a coiffure of lustrous black cornrows. Footnote 70. Brothers Charles and Jack had returned to Morgan City years before and helped their sister Jacqueline care for their ailing mother. Imelda was a social worker in Chicago. End of footnote. Judge Dickey waited till the cheering subsided, then made his own entrance as the bailiff intoned the patriotic call to order. The day's first witness was Clayton Anderson, former commander of the DA's Intelligence Division. Early in the examination, Hanlon picked up a sheet of paper and asked, "May I approach Mr. Anderson, Your Honor?" As Hanlon stepped into the well of the court, two bailiffs rushed to head him off. In some courtrooms, this area just below the bench was hallowed ground. Intrusions were regarded as symbolic attacks on the judge. If a lawyer received permission to approach a witness or the bench, he was expected to walk around the well. The Pratt lawyers realized the enormity of Hanlon's gaffe when the judge frowned and said in distinct tones, "Not through the well." Cochran whispered to his colleague, "This is Southern California." Hanlon bowed slightly toward the bench and said, "In Northern California, we can do that. I won't make that mistake again, Your Honor." The judge nodded without changing expression. Early in Clayton Anderson's testimony, it became clear why Hanlon had asked that the retired police official be designated a hostile witness. Despite a sworn declaration in which he'd repeatedly used the term confidential informant to describe Julius Butler, Anderson now insisted that he hadn't meant informant, but source. Hanlon asked if he discussed the matter with the DA's office, and Anderson admitted that he had. A long semantic argument ensued, with Brentford Ferreira peppering the discussion with objections. The examination turned even more contentious at the first mention of a key figure in the case. Question: did you ever go to Richard Kalustian prior to or during the trial and tell him that you had a card in your drawer locked up in a confidential informant index listing Julio Butler as an informant? Answer, no. Question, okay, why not? Answer, I didn't make any connection between any. Question, were you aware that Butler was one of the key witnesses in the trial? Answer, I don't recall if I was aware of that or not. Question, did Mr. Bowles work the case with Mr. Kaloustian? Answer, I believe he assisted Mr. Kaloustian. Question, and Mr. Bowles worked for you? Answer, that's correct. Question, and you were the keeper of the information, right? It was in your locked desk. Answer, that's correct. Question, and were you aware that Julio Butler was a witness? Answer, I don't know that I was aware. I simply don't recall. After almost an hour of jousting, Hanlon could see that Commander Clayton Anderson was unlikely to confirm any connection between Kaloustian and the informant files on Butler. Outside the courtroom after the testimony, Cochran complained to reporters that his opponents were still playing word games to justify the result they want. We have spent 25 years where so-called intellectual people play word games. In many respects, it's intellectually dishonest. Hanlon told the press that he was looking forward to the next day's confrontation between Julio Butler, who lied on the stand, and Johnny Cochran, who was hoodwinked. In a page one article in the next morning's edition of the Los Angeles Times, Edward J. Boyer wrote, "For almost 25 years, Johnny L. Cochran Jr. has been waiting to get Julius Butler into a courtroom where he could be put under oath and questioned about his role as an informant for law enforcement. Cochran will get that opportunity today." Before the blunt force meeting began, the judge made a short speech. "I just want to indicate to the spectators," Dickey said in an avuncular manner, "I understand that there are strong feelings about this case, and particularly with respect to Mr. Butler, and that is something that is understandable. But I cannot permit anyone in the courtroom to, by gesture or words or any other method, to convey your feelings about the witness's testimony. If you are not capable of keeping them to yourself, then you should leave the courtroom before the witness testifies. And if anyone does what I ask you not to do, and the bailiff is able to identify those persons, they will be excluded from the proceedings." Hanlon had never heard a more artful warning to a partisan audience. For the rest of the hearing, stirrings in the crowd were put down by the merest glance from the bench. "That's what they call command presence," Hanlon said to himself. "The guy doesn't even have to raise his voice."
Context of white supremacy. So we will pick up there next week. Again, we should only have about two sections left, and we are all done. I did want to make sure I include, before we get to some of the readers, now they mentioned with Judge Dickey, very unpopular, unsuccessful recall effort. They mentioned that he released a child molester,
because there was some sort of impropriety during the trial with the jurors, so released him. And then he mentioned the case with the two teenagers, so-called Latinos, where they killed this white male, and they were upset with the sentence. This is in the LA Times as well. So I thought I'd read a little bit of this. The sentencing for this case is the same month, January 1995, that the O.J. Simpson trial began, right? So this is context. So LA Times, the article is two teenagers are sentenced in Woods case, courts, mother of youth killed by paint roller rod storms out of hearing as defendants are condemned to state youth authority rather than prison. In a decision that brought both relief and anger, a judge on Friday sentenced two youths to the California Youth Authority rather than state prison for the second-degree murder of a San Clemente teenager who died after being speared through the head with a paint roller. Hector Penulas and Julio Perez Bonilla, both 18, showed no visible emotion at the sentence, which followed a tense hearing that included a tearful outburst by the sister of Steve Woods, the 17-year-old victim, holding a large framed picture of her smiling brother and shaking as she walked into a restricted area in front of the judge and the defendants. Shelley Woods told the young men, "This is who you destroyed." Woods was in the passenger seat of a friend's Chevrolet Suburban when a paint roller rod pierced his skull during a confrontation. October 15, 1993, between two groups of young people at a Calafia Beach County Park in San Clemente. He died 25 days later, never having regained consciousness. While citing the senseless nature of the crime, Superior Court Judge Everett W. Dickey said he chose to send the defendants to the youth authority, where generally they cannot be held past age 25, in the hope that they can turn their young lives around. The defendants may be in a gang, but they are not hardcore members, Dickey said. They are not defendants who are unchangeable, and they have no previous record of violence. Dickey said he understood that family and friends want vengeance and a maximum sentence. But in his experience, Dickey said, young defendants sent to state prison can become a greater problem to society when they are eventually paroled. Dickey said psychological assessments of the young men showed they have learning and language disabilities and would benefit from educational and other programs offered in the California Youth Authority. I can't bring Stephen Woods back, Dickey said. Nonetheless, these young men are not predators. They are not criminally sophisticated, and there's nothing to suggest they're firmly entrenched in the gang lifestyle. Kathy Woods, the victim's mother, stormed out of the courtroom in disgust as Dickey started giving his reasons for the sentence. My thought was, I don't care what your reasons are, Kathy Woods said later. You have just jeopardized other people's lives. I am so disgusted, Shelley Woods said outside the courtroom. My brother didn't get justice today. They're getting a rap on the knuckles, and that's all they're getting. Members of the defendants' families breathed a collective sigh of relief after the judge's decision was explained to them by Carlos Negrete, their attorney in a wrongful death civil case brought by the Woods family. I think the judge understood that these boys are different. They're not gangsters, said Penulas' father, Cipriano Penulas. This was an accident. Yes, it was unfortunate, but my son never intended to go out and kill anyone. He's not like that. Let's see. Give one little bit more. It says, Friday's sentencing marked just another chapter in a highly charged case that sent shockwaves through the San Clemente community, a community known for its beaches and as home to the Western White House during Richard Nixon's presidency. Outraged residents held rallies and protests to complain about youth violence and gangs, but the tragedy also exposed racial divisions in neighborhoods besides the beaches. Latino activists complained that race was behind the murder charges, but prosecutors called such accusations ludicrous and said the charges and convictions were based on facts, not the race of the victim or defendants. The two were the first of six defendants to go on trial. A third pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and awaits sentencing, while a fourth man was recently found guilty by a jury of second-degree murder. Two remaining defendants, including Hector Penulas' older brother, await trial. I will stop there. There's a little bit more to it, but this was apparently a really big case. And as I said, the sentencing that I just read about, this was January 95, the same month that the Simpson trial began. And this is the judge, Judge Dickey, who eventually would release Geronimo Pratt, who they attempted to recall before we even got to Pratt's hearing. They tried to recall him about this case and the child molestation case. But wowee, racism, white supremacy. And even I'd say even with this case, if it had been some black people who killed Mr. Woods, I don't know. Maybe they get the youth sentenced to the youth authority, California Youth Authority. Maybe they just get classified as predators and we ship them off, three strikes and you're out of here. You know, that type of thing. But that did happen. Folks can check out a little bit more. Lots of odd little cases mentioned here and there along the way that also deal with white supremacy, racism. So the number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. One of our investors, he wrote in, continuing the orange curtain, Hanlon discussed the Cochrane effect. Some of our people saw Johnny as a slick guy who would bring the wrong persona to Orange County, especially if the judge turned out to be a racist. They said the judge might be intimidated or pissed, and the whole hearing would focus on Johnny. The judge might say, "This is a guy who got a murderer off. I'll fix his ass. I've been dealing with Johnny Cochran for 20 years. He's a goddamn fine courtroom lawyer." Stop right there. More Black Miss Andre. Johnny Cochran couldn't just be a skilled lawyer. He was a slick, which I think is a pejorative term, engaging in questionable, if not frankly, illegal practices. I agree totally about the word slick. It has those all of those connotations that there might be something criminal, illegal, you know, about what it is that you're doing. Might even be deceptive, right, with what it is that you're doing. Incidentally, just with this passage right here. So, I mean, it's, I felt it was so loaded. That's why I said, now, something to think about. Johnny Cochran apparently even said something to think about. But I mean, the book that we've read here, they said Johnny Cochran wins Lawyer of the Year. What defendant says, "I don't know, this Lawyer of the Year guy, he's got all these flashy clothes, slick talking, OJ, yeah, I don't know, I'm going to take a risk on this Cochran fella. Yeah, let's get somebody else in." Like, really? Like, what in the world? What in the world? And even unpacking more just right here. Now, all the suits and stuff. Now, I'm not a snappy dresser. I'm not an attorney either, but I'm not the snappiest dresser. However, in a system of white supremacy, and remember, we read O.J. Simpson, Jeffrey Toobin. He talked about the incident where Johnny Cochran was pulled over at gunpoint with his children in the vehicle. Vanity plates on his car, no less. JCJR. Now, if I get pulled over in my luxury vehicle with my beautiful little girls in the vehicle, that maybe might influence me. I'm going to make sure I don't just go out here dressed any old kind of way. I am going to look like I am a professional, a litigator, someone I can afford to be where I am. I'm not just going to go in the court. He can't do, you know, the Stuart Hamlet. I can just do my Jufro, right? Get my afro and just go in here all rumpled and wrinkled. No. I don't think victim of white supremacy, a black victim of white supremacy, I just don't think you're going to be able to do that. No, you don't have to be really slick and get the most expensive everything and be super sharp with the way you dress and all that. But I mean, hey, system of white supremacy racism. He could go and get a what do they call it? The bargain bin suit. I guess he could go and do that and see how that works. I don't think that's going to improve things, but. And even still, continuing just unpacking this little section right here that I found fascinating. The judge might be racist. Really? Really? We could have a racist judge. Imagine that. In a system that's supposed to be fair. And then they say, we might have a racist judge. The judge might be intimidated or pissed, and the whole hearing would be focused on Johnny. Really? The judge might say, this is a guy who got a murderer off. Well, wait a minute. He was exonerated? What do you mean he got a murderer off? I know some white people think that, but I mean, yeah. A judge shouldn't be thinking that way. Like a court of law adjudicated, not guilty. What do you mean got a murderer off? And he says, judge might say, this guy got a murderer off. I'll fix his ass. Rethinking Rufus. The delectable Negro, those type of phrases in a system of white supremacy. We've had all this sodomy and rape and all the rest of it. I'll fix his ass. Quite a bit just in that little section there. Continuing, listener writes, investor Enigma in Robes. Number one, Sondheim prosecutor argued for more time. Hanlon got the impression that the prosecutors had been caught off guard, that they'd expected a quick win by judicial fiat or at least continuance over the holidays. They were confident in the Voltron effect. Yes, they were thinking, we got this one. He'll just give us the rubber stamp and what? Trial? What? What is going on here? Next, cream cheese and potato salad. Number one, it was the only black law office I'd ever seen. From the receptionist to the other partners, every person you saw was an African American. I thought, how fitting. G's in prison because he's black. Was he threatened by the sight of non-white black victims collectively engaged in constructive activities? Question. I suspect he was. Interesting observation. Wow. I also, this passage stuck out to me for totally different reasons. I asked M. Wesley Swearingen this exact question. Geronimo Pratt, isn't he in prison because he's black? That's the only reason he's in prison, is because he's classified as black. Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I didn't care if he was black or polka dot or purple or all this other stuff. Like, come on. Next, number two. Johnny would say, I already sent out potato salad, cream cheese, cartons of fattening food, Louisiana food. Jim McCloskey said, hey, Johnny, you forgot the chitlins. Non-white victims eating healthier is an important method of countering racism, white supremacy. Did I mention Dr. Ruby Lathan? Just supposed to be on the program yesterday. Her father just passed away. Again, condolences, but absolutely. Man, eating correctly. Johnny Cochran died at 65, brain aneurysm, but I mean, woo. This is not good food. He continues, moreover, the reference to chitlins reads like a racist joke. I would agree. Number three, Hanlon's biggest problem was to convince his co-counsel to pace himself. Cochran was involved in a dozen matters at a time in a police abuse case. He'd won one of the largest awards in LA history, won the Simpson case. He seemed to do everything on a high-octane basis. This reads like jealousy on the part of Hanlon. Convincing Johnny Cochran to pace himself sounds like an attempt to control him by a suspected racist who is intimidated by his brilliance. I would agree. And that was mentioned, right, that the judge might be intimidated by Johnny Cochran. Maybe Stuart Hanlon was intimidated by Johnny Cochran. Remember when they met, Hanlon was a law student, so Cochran's older than him. He's super impressed by his office, like, oh my gosh, he's got all these conferences and suites and the kitchen, and he's got only Negroes working for him. Who is this Cochran guy? And he's got this big expensive car and all the rest of it, so it would not surprise me at all. Next chapter, Cat and Mouse. Number one, Hanlon developed a theory about Cochran's dress style. After all these years, he still has no idea what a great lawyer he is. He told his wife he has a need to be polished to be a fashion plate in a $5,000 suit. I think he wonders if he can do the job without all the trappings. Also, he believes in the system and dresses up to show his respect. You never had that problem, Kathy said. As a non-white victim, I suspect Johnny Cochran knew he had to use all the techniques at his disposal to be taken seriously, including his dress, something which was never required of Hanlon. As a person classified as white, Hanlon's credibility is assumed, Jew, fro, and all. And it seemed his white colleagues and his wife picked at him for his shabby attire. No matter, I'm a white, and we can even do a compilation here. So we got Hanlon, he's smoking cocaine or snorting cocaine, shabby dress, potty mouth, filing briefings late, lied to get in to see Geronimo Pratt to begin with, said he was his attorney and he was a law student. All no matter. Classified as white, more than enough of a credential. Johnny Cochran doesn't have all that. I need everything I can get. Slick suits and slick talk and everything else. I'm a victim of white supremacy. I might be pulled over at gunpoint with my children for a second time. Much obliged, folks who wrote in. People who dialed in, if we didn't get to hear from you at all, do not wait until the very end. B in Santa Rosa should be with us. We missed you the first time around. If you have commentary, proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, man, you hit the nail on the head and the person who wrote in. I have nothing to say. Like, everything I was going to say was already said. I'm just going to mute my line and enjoy the show. Thank you.
Dang. Well, that was one of our investors who wrote in. But dang, glad we took all your, or not glad, sorry we took all of your commentary, sir. Yeah. The Johnny Cochran portion I thought was pretty important, especially about the dress. I thought that was a really important critique. Perhaps once you hear a little bit more feedback, maybe you'll, if anything else comes to mind, or if you have extra thought you want to share with us as well. Let's see. Retired
fireman.
Yes, sir. Going right to you.
Yes. I'm going to go over some of the same points, but I may say some slightly different things. With the advent of Mr. Cochran not only attempting to be the best Johnny Cochran, he also backs it up by employing other non-white black people. A job such as a physician or a attorney is one of the few places that I think, from a codified point of view, that should have things on the wall, because primarily if a lawyer doesn't have his certifications on the wall, then you probably would feel that you're in the wrong place if he or she doesn't have their accomplishment, their legal accomplishments and certifications up on the wall somewhere. And also, it's by it being a business, you want to attract people to your business. And he certainly has done, during his lifetime, had did a very good job legally.
Also, the comment, "Hey Johnny, you forgot the chitlins." Well, I would say the best racist, trashy talkers would be firefighters, white firefighters. And so I'm quite used to those type of comments. My response that was always no laughter at all. I would look at that person with a straight face. Well, of course, they wouldn't be talking to me anyway. But it'd be the expectation that everybody's supposed to laugh. And unfortunately, there would be some non-white people who would laugh. But they would always get a stare when they would say things of that nature. And that kind of like would classify me in a certain particular way. And they wouldn't bother to have that type of relationship with me. With the advent of the way Mr. Cochran dressed, I just state the word professional. You know, if you're going to do something, then you do it to the best that you possibly can. And he followed that process. He followed that process, from my understanding, all through his life. So I don't have any problem with it at all, especially with the profession that he chose to be in. And I think that's it. I think that's everything that I have. Yes, that's everything that I have. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. I will go through my notes and then double check, see if anybody else has anything else they want to share. We should have two more of these sessions before we wrap up. Be thinking of concluding thoughts, even how you might connect these two cases, what that can help one understand about the system of white supremacy, kind of joining these cases together. This is a substantial chunk, the life and times of Johnny L. Cochran Jr., and Gil Garcetti to some degree as well. Let's see. My note again, there is a documentary, Black Behind the Orange Curtain. If you want to get more details about this specific part of California, we got a General Patton mention. The movie Patton, eponymously named the first 5 minutes. That is a great little segue of white supremacy racism, because they mention that Judge Dickey, he's got guts, and that's how the movie opens, with General Patton talking, "We're gonna kill him. We're gonna kill him by the bushel. We're gonna see their guts spill." And all the killing, killing, killing. Yes, lots of killing. System of white supremacy. Let's see. Next, they got Judge turns out to be rowdy. Talked about that. Yeah, it can't start off with just, "Wow, this Johnny Cochran is amazing." Like, do you think anybody else could have successfully litigated the Simpson case to a victory? Like, wow, that guy is amazing. Like, oh yeah, we want him. But no. This slick talking guy, and he's got all these flashy suits and OJ, and I don't know. Jeez, like, now, if this is Johnny Cochran, what do they say about just a regular attorney, regular black person? Like, you don't have all those credentials. You don't have presidents on the wall and everything. Like, wow. Let's see. We get so many John Wayne mentions here. The local airport was named after John Wayne, and a statue of the conservative avatar looked down on them as they disembarked. The airport is still named John Wayne, and this is even after George Floyd. They had a big to-do. You can check the LA Times on that one, too. Like, man, it is 2021. Should the airport still be named after John Wayne, who talked openly about how he believed in white supremacy, and then his film career supports that? But they just talked about it, and apparently, yes, system of white supremacy, even after the Rona and everything else, we still want the airport named after John Wayne. Nothing has changed. Let's see.
We just Dickey defeated the recall movement. I just read Latino killers for for light sentencing of two Latino killers. I mean, wow. Like, I don't know what type of reputation he has in Southern California. So in the span of like 5 years, this white judge, James Dickey, he sends these two non-white, I suspect, males to the youth facility as opposed to male rape everybody prison. Lets this child molester off. And then lets Geronimo Pratt go, like, yikes, which gives another victory to Johnny Cochran. Like, yikes, who is this guy? Like, you can get out of here, too. Like, send him to the John Wayne Airport. New judge. Let's see. This Jack Olson's phrasing, now I said last week when he described Jim McCloskey when he was going door to door and he said something, it sounded like a black person snatched him inside and her eyes got as big as pancakes. Like, oh my God, what are you doing wearing that red around here? Get out of there. Think before you put something on, put clothes on. And I said, what a black person, I see they do that, saying black people got bulging eyes and that's been a big joke for years, decades really. And so then this time around he says, Virginia Pratt, still teaching problem children in the ghetto. That's just one of those right up there with like Chitlins and all the rest, like a white person saying, oh yeah, she's working with the poor problem children in the ghetto. Like, the ghetto is a creation of white supremacy, racism, and individuals who are classified as white, like our author here, Jack Olson. And I feel like this book was written in 2000. They could have, problem children in the urban area, disadvantaged youth who need an act. I mean, there's a lot of other ways that they could say it. Like, yeah, she's working in the ghetto. Let's see. Enigma in robes. They've got all this pomp. Just for me, all of the pomp and circumstance, you got to get up and pledge allegiance to the flag and you can't walk right here. Like, a lot of that is having a lot of reverence for a system of total terrorism. I mean, yeah, he did eventually let Geronimo Pratt out. But I mean, after 25 years and countless murder attempts and rape and sleeping in your urine and waste and all the rest of it, like, we're supposed to revere all of the, oh, don't walk through the well. My goodness, what are you talking? Like, come on. Nothing sacred in a system of white supremacy racism. We're in a, what did Dr. Kanban say? Global cesspool. That's what this is. Oh, man, make sure I get to this was, I thought was super important. So they're going, Judge Dickey says, nope, we're going to move forward. My calendar's open. We're going to go December 16. Hanlon has the audacity to get up and he says, Hanlon entered a mild demurrer for the record. Your Honor, he said, I hate to agree with the DA and we would like to move this case along too, but it's the Christmas season. Some of us have kids and family. Are you flipping serious? Now, as I was narrating this, I immediately flashed back. Cal's Archive, what have we been doing for a dozen years? December, let me get in my brain. Oh, no, not December. No. So this is July 2010. We had Timothy Wise on the program, admitted white supremacist. And I said, come hang out with us for Christmas Day. And he said, what? Christmas Day? That's ridiculous. Some of us have family and kids. And I said, that is appalling. We're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Some fat man allegedly coming down a chimney, some fat white man or whatever other rituals. And Timothy Wise is so-called Jewish, just like Stuart Hanlon here with his Jufro. Whatever all that is supposed to be associated with, that is way second to replacing white supremacy with justice. Any of these so-called holidays in the trash with all of that. Are you serious? I've been sleeping in my own urine and feces, and you want to tell me that, oh man, Christmas is approaching, and maybe we can table this until January. Are you out of your foot? You're fired. He's fired. Get somebody else. Like, are you out of your flipping mind? So you can go snort cocaine and open Christmas gifts. And then come back at the beginning of the year and we can start this. Come on. I'm so glad the judge came back to say, I also understand that you asked for a prompt hearing. Your client's been incarcerated since December 10, 1970. You claim he's being held illegally. That's what habeas corpus is all about. Like, come on, that's the way you should talk. If we're serious, let's do justice. Let's not sit here and waste time. We got somebody, Geronimo Pratt could have been killed, raped, all of the above, while they got him at Mule Creek and all these other facilities, hobnobbing with Charles Manson and such. Today, let's get this cracking. Sitting here wasting time talking about Christmas. Let's see. And then they come back. Co-counsel Robert Garcia, NAACP lawyer. Not that that makes it any better. Oh, judge, can't the courtroom be dark on Christmas Eve? That's another one right up there with Got Us in the Mud and In the Dark. Everything that's close to niggardly and darkness and black people is ignorant and vile and confused and turned off and not working correctly. All of that. Yes, we'll have the courtroom dark for Christmas Eve. Get in here, Christmas Day, Christmas Eve. Let's ride, man. I've been wasting time for 25 years. Come on. And then all that, Hamlin strode past the statue of John Wayne and boarded an evening flight to San Francisco. The symbolism of racism, white supremacy abounds, especially when you know what you're looking at. Is there anything else we can name? Cream cheese. Already mentioned that one. Already mentioned the food. Banana cream pie. I did just think of making banana cream pie, but a slightly healthier version than what they're talking about. Let's see. Release the file. You have to take a judge's word that there's no smoking gun in the file. Let's release the files. Let's release the files. Let's see. Cat and mouse. I think I'm so appalled. I'm very sure that Johnny Cochran knew he was an exemplary lawyer. I don't think you can receive the Lawyer of the Year award and be confused and think that you are incompetent as a litigator. In fact, I thought the reason that he talked about, yes, I should be involved and should be the lead for the O.J. Simpson case, is because his partner in all of this, not Bob Kardashian, the other Bob, that he was not a trial litigator. That was what it was. It wasn't that, you know, I don't know that I'm a good lawyer. Like, get out of here. Let's see. Else, the last chapter. Yeah, don't walk through the court. Well, buckets of words and lying. So many people lying on the witness stand. And I wasn't an informer. I was a liaison. Like, all of that is so appalling. And I'm so glad that Johnny Cochran pulled it out to just say that these people are being dishonest with all these word games. It's intellectually dishonest. Like, it's total nonsense. And to have somebody who's been encaged for 25 years and have people sitting around playing, well, he wasn't really an informant, he was a liaison, and come on, stop lying. What did it say the other day? This is not mythology, this is just white people lying. Oh, and we did quite a cliffhanger, because the very next chapter is Julio Butler under oath. This is a big chapter, so this will be exactly where we pick up at next week. There's a big LA Times article on Julio Butler and the congregation, what they had to say about him and all that good stuff. Different caller in California, 1159. Did you have commentary as well? 1159.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. This book is just a really terrifying example of the powerful system of white supremacy, and it shed so much constructive information on how racist men and racist women practice racism in so many ways. I thought it was really interesting that Hamlin's wife, to me it seemed like that was an example of Hamlin attempting to practice racism in a different way, and she having her own way of attempting to practice racism by maybe attempting to have him consider to look at the case differently or understand Geronimo's Pratt endeavors. But any correct thinking person should understand the misery one should experience, one would experience for being falsely imprisoned for two decades and more than two decades. And I lost my other thoughts, but yeah, terrifying story. This should be one of the millions of reasons why non-white people should really attempt to get serious about solving this problem, because the world doesn't need to be this way. I'll meet my line.
Much obliged, sir. Right in your area, California. Yikes, Southern California. Yes, should motivate, because this sort of thing happens all the time, and generally you will not have a Reverend McCloskey or Johnny Cochran in his slick talking and nice suits to come and, you know, be in your corner for two decades or three decades, maybe. That's probably not going to be the case. And have Congresswoman Maxine Waters, you know, write a letter on your behalf, Sean Penn to come send you banana bread while you're in bed. Probably not going to happen. You'll just be in greater confinement and hoping that the gruel improves. You get to keep your toilet, not get raped.
Can I share another word?
Yes, sir.
Another example of just awesome white power practiced by Hamlin is Geronimo's Pratt inability to fire him. Hamlin just said, no, I'm going to stay on the case. I assume that the victim, I just assumed people had the so-called right to choose their lawyers and their defense team, but perhaps white power dictates who is going to represent folks in greater confinement and folks pretend, and just people on trial in general. I'm going to lie.
Absolutely. It can be Robert Shapiro. How did I forget his name? I said the two Bobs. Yes. It can be very difficult. It's in a system of white supremacy, and especially when you're talking a legal system and a criminal case. Oh, yeah. It can be quite an ordeal to ditch your attorney at times if white people want to make it difficult. Colin Ferguson, he was eventually his own attorney, but even that, like, I think a white person might have had to make, or I know a white person had to make a decision about that if you're going to be allowed to do that, because sometimes they say, no, you cannot be your own attorney and, you know, sit down and be quiet. That's just what it's going to be. So, yeah, lots of manifestations of racism, white supremacy. Sometimes you can't even fire a white person who's working for you. Anywho, I think we should have two of these and then we should be done. Should be a high point next week. Julio Butler taking the stand and being questioned about his role in all of this case and what have you. Even though Julio Butler is a black male, do not ever be mistaken. The people who are most to blame for this are white. They can strategically use black people like Mr. Butler. We talked about that. Very easy in a system of white supremacy. But I mean, wow, the people who are to blame for this, Calustian all the way up, FBI and everyone else, are all classified. Gil Garcetti are all classified as white. Anywho, we'll be here tomorrow neutralizing workplace racism quite a bit to chat about with the whole change in safety policies across the boards in lots of places, like overnight almost. But we'll chat that up tomorrow amongst other items, and then we'll be here for the compensatory call-in on Saturday. Much obliged for folks' participation. Hopefully it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Sorry to our other caller in California. He said we stole all his thunder. Did we miss anything? Double checking. Did we miss anything? Make sure. Be in Santa Rosa. Everything was good. We didn't leave out anything. Nothing you wanted to add?
No, we're pretty much good. It's just the cesspool of of this disgustingness going on. The lawyer doing cocaine, and the people on the prosecutor side lying, and it's like we can't even practice justice. It's horrible. That's all. That's the only thing that's running through my mind.
And they continue using the word fair. We heard that word so many times this week. Fair. He's fair.
Oh, yeah.
He's fair. Be fair. Like, there's nothing fair, we'd mean justice, about any of this. Now, they mean something else with the word fair, I guess, but no justice here at all. Lots of racism, white supremacy culture, and homoeroticism. I'll fix his ass. That's what they said about Johnny Cochran. I'll fix his ass. That is the system of white supremacy. Black misandry, cesspool, through and through. I'll fix his ass. Indeed. We'll be here tomorrow, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Motivation. That sounds logical to me. All of this should be motivation. We need to get this problem solved immediately. Sobriety would be best. You heard him snorting cocaine and what have you, the attorney, and then they'll turn around and fuss at you and say, drugs are bad. Got to put you in jail. Can't do that. It's horrible. What is going on? Sobriety would be best. We need our brain computer to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, if you're going to go out, be very alert. I guess it's, you know, about to be summertime and on and cracking. We're making up for lost time. It's a lot of folks who are still rowdy and armed about everything. I would be very alert. If folks look like they are being hostile about things, they want to question you. Why don't you have a mask? Let me see your vaccine card or whatever it is. Exit. It is not a good time to be like confronting strangers. You should be thinking this person may be armed, might be with a whole cadre of people who are also armed. Just be super alert to what is happening around you. If you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, this is not a good time for just confronting strangers in public. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. No name calling in the 10 stops for a reason. Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, phenomenal illustration of minimizing conflict with non-white people in like extremely stressful and dire circumstances. And I mean, brilliant illustration of minimizing conflict with other non-white people. I'm not going to sit here and argue and fuss about religion and all that. Not going to call you names, not gossiping. Minimizing conflict, key to replacing white supremacy with justice. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.